You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the September 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Monday, September 11th, was the 16th anniversary of the attacks on New York World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and, as in every year since 2001, somber tributes to those who died that day took place at Ground Zero in Washington and across the country. If at any of these ceremonies a word was said or there was a moment of silence asked for the millions who have been killed, wounded, or made refugees by the actions of the United States in response to those attacks, I'm not aware. That's something that concerned U.S. General Stanley McChrystal when he took over as a commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan in June 2009. I believe the perception caused by civilian casualties is one of the most dangerous enemies we face, he said at the time. Unfortunately, the past 8 years have shown McChrystal had nothing to worry about. Civilian casualties caused by U.S. troops more recently, be they in Iraq and assisting Iraqi forces in retaking Mosul from ISIS, in Syria where 978 civilians have reportedly been killed in the past 3 months, or providing tactical support for Saudi Arabia in its continuing air war on cholera-ridden Yemen, seems to have attracted little attention from the public. When it comes to the war in the greater Middle East, maybe we're the bad guys. Those aren't my words, but those of U.S. Army Major Danny Sherson from the title of his recent article on the Tom Dispatch website titled, Worth Dying For? When it comes to the war in the greater Middle East, maybe we're the bad guys, which is particularly significant because Sherson remains on active duty, stationed at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, after having served tours of duty in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Keep in mind, he writes, that the war for the greater Middle East is just the latest adventure in the depressing annals of Washington's geostrategic thinking since President Ronald Reagan's administration, along with the Saudis and Pakistanis, armed, funded, and supported extreme fundamentalist Afghan Mujahideen rebels in a Cold War struggle with the Soviet Union that eventually led to the 9/11 attacks, end quote. A remarkable statement from Major Danny Sherson on an off-duty and on-duty member of the military service, from whom you will hear even more at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. As for 9/11, mere mention, let alone discussions or debates over questions that remain about the attack and the government's official narrative that I have covered on past programs, remain off-limits for the mainstream and its alternative equivalents, much as has been the case with the assassination of President Kennedy. Whether one accepts or not the official narrative, isn't that curious? There's little, if any, notice that the men planning the 9/11 attacks have been sitting in cages in Guantanamo for more than a decade without apparently any plan by the government to bring them to trial. On the potential war fronts, and where would we be without them, North Korea, a country which the U.S. Air Force literally decimated 65 years ago, was subjected to more U.N. sanctions on Monday for continuing to develop its nuclear weapons program despite threats from Washington that include the option of a preventive military strike. What triggered the U.N. move was the North's sixth and largest nuclear test this month. It was the ninth resolution unanimously adopted by the 15-member Security Council over North Korea's ballistic missile and nuclear programs since 2006. In order to get another unanimous vote, the U.S. was obliged to soften the original resolution to avoid a Russian or Chinese veto. Thus, Washington had to be content with banning North Korea's textile exports, capping fuel supplies, and prohibiting North Koreans from working in other countries. Since China ships its oil to the North through a pipeline, the resolution will have little effect on its fuel supplies. Preventing North Koreans from working abroad will be difficult to enforce since most of them, almost 50,000, work in either China or Russia. Others can be found in a multitude of countries across Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. According to a 2012 report by the International Network for the Human Rights of North Koreans Overseas Labor, Pyongyang takes in between 1.2 and 2.3 billion annually from their labor. The biggest story that emerged from the UN vote was the escalating threats against China on the part of Washington. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin warned China that if it did not follow through on the new sanctions, the U.S. would, quote, put additional sanctions on them and prevent them from accessing the U.S. and international dollar system, end quote. An unnamed senior administration official told Reuters any such, quote, secondary sanctions on Chinese banks and other companies were on hold for now to give China time to show it was prepared to fully enforce the latest and previous rounds of sanctions. Asked if Trump was considering cutting off Chinese banks and the U.S. financial systems, White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, all options are on the table. The president has also said that he wants every country involved to step up and do more. This, she said, was a small step in that process, and we're hoping that they'll take a greater role and more active role in putting pressure on North Korea, end quote. Washington notes the Reuters article has so far mostly held off on new sanctions against Chinese banks and other companies doing business with North Korea, given fears of retaliation by Beijing and possibly far-reaching effects on the world economy. That's putting it mildly. China currently holds $1.24 trillion of U.S. debt, in the form of bills, notes, and bonds, which constitute 30% of our foreign debt. Moreover, the U.S. is heavily dependent on the importation of Chinese products, particularly in the construction industry. For the first 7 months of 2017, the trade deficit between the two countries was just under $205 billion in Chinese favor, an average of slightly more than $29 billion per month, just above the monthly figure for the last year of the Obama administration. In other words, Washington's tough talk over China is purely for public consumption. Meanwhile, the war of words continues against Iran, with President Trump openly looking for an excuse to withdraw the U.S. from the deal negotiated last year by Secretary of State John Kerry with Tehran, with the backing of the other four permanent members of the U.N. Security Council and Germany. While the agreement lifted international sanctions against Iran for its agreeing to cut back its nuclear enrichment program for 10 years, it had no effect on the sanctions against Tehran that had been approved by Congress on the urging of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and its lobby AIPAC, the only agency representing the interests of a foreign government not required to register as a foreign agent. On September 5th, Nikki Haley, Trump's U.N. representative and an outspoken critic of Iran and the agreement, spoke about the subject before the American Enterprise Institute, a longtime bastion of the nation's neocons. Next month, she told her audience, President Trump will once again be called upon to declare whether he finds Iran in compliance with the terms of the deal. It should be noted, she added, this requirement to assess compliance has not come from the deal itself. It was created by Congress in the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, also known as the Corker-Cardin Law. That's a very important distinction to keep in mind, she said, because many people confuse the requirements of the deal with the requirements of U.S. law. I'm not going to prejudge in any way what the president's going to decide next month, Haley said. While I've discussed it with him, I do not know what decision he will make. It's his decision to make and his alone. And then she proceeded to not only trash the deal but deny the legitimacy of Iran as a nation. The Islamic Republic of Iran was born in an act of international law-breaking, she said. On November 4, 1979, a group of Islamic revolutionary students overran the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. In violation of international law, they held 52 American Marines and diplomats hostage for 444 days. For the 38 years since, she went on, the Iranian regime has existed outside the community of law-abiding nations. Henry Kissinger famously said, she reminded the audience, that Iran can't decide whether it is a nation or a cause. Since 1979, the regime has behaved like a cause, she continued. The cause is spreading revolutionary Shiite Islam by force. Its main enemy and rallying point has been and continues to be what's called the Great Satan, the United States of America, end quote. No mention by Haley, of course, about the CIA coup against the elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 that installed the Shah on his peacock throne. No mention that the U.S. had backed Saddam Hussein and provided Iraq with the material to manufacture chemical weapons that he would be used in the war on Iran following the Shah's overthrow. And no credible evidence of Iran spreading revolutionary Islam by force, because no such evidence exists. Soon after the revolution, Haley told her audience, the Iran Revolutionary Guards was created to protect the revolution from foreign and domestic enemies, and soon after its creation, the IRGC founded Hezbollah to spread Iran's influence and revolution abroad, end quote. Not so. The IRGC was founded as part of the new Iranian government in 1979. Hezbollah arose in Lebanon in 1983, 4 years later, as an indigenous resistant movement to Israel's occupation following its brutal invasion the previous June. No matter, after 1988, she claims, quote, under the IRGC's direction, Hezbollah then expanded its lethal reach to Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Americas in search of victims to kill. Actually, what Hezbollah was doing at the time was escalating its resistance to Israeli occupation. This bore fruit in 2000 when, bowing to Israeli public pressure, the Israeli army was forced to withdraw its troops back across the border. Well, today, Haley insisted, Hezbollah is doing the Iranian regime's dirty work, supporting the war crimes of Syria's Assad, and is building an arsenal of weapons and battle-hardened fighters in Lebanon in preparation for war, end quote. Well, even the mainstream media has reported that Hezbollah has been battling ISIS and the al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra from the time it entered the fighting in Syria, but curiously, there's not a single reference to either ISIS or al-Qaeda in Haley's entire speech. In her presentation at the American Enterprise Institute, Haley literally blamed every attack on U.S. forces in the region over the past 30 years on Iran, directly or indirectly, including, quote, the thousands of American men and women who were wounded or killed in Iraq. Haley's attacks at Hezbollah coincided with the beginning of the Israeli army's largest drill in 20 years near the Lebanese border that encompasses ground, air, sea forces, and intelligence operations. The drill, which will be overseen by the Israel Defense Forces Northern Command, was expected to last about 10 days. It was to include a scenario of instant escalation in which the Israeli army has to defend Israel against multiple terrorist infiltrations in the north. Well, the purpose of the drill is to test the fitness of the Northern Command and the relevant battalions during an emergency, said a top IDF officer. In the drill scenario, the cabinet tells the armed forces to vanquish Hezbollah. And quote, as I understand it, the state in which Hezbollah either has no ability to do or desire to attack anymore, end quote, explained the officer. The Israeli military is still smarting from the last time it engaged Hezbollah. In a month of fighting during the summer of 2006, the invading Israeli army was not only repulsed but humiliated to the point where the army chief of staff, Dan Halutz, was forced to resign soon afterward. Israel's air force, however, provided to Tel Aviv at U.S. taxpayers' expense, was able to kill over 1,000 Lebanese and destroy a considerable amount of its infrastructure, as well as whole apartment blocks in Beirut, as it had done in 1982, for which Hezbollah had no answer but to continue firing rockets into Israel. In recent months, The Israeli press has run numerous articles about the coming war with Hezbollah as if it was a hurricane and its arrival inevitable. It may well be that this time around the difference in competence between the Hezbollah fighters who have become battle-hardened in Syria and the Israeli soldiers who have been patrolling the West Bank as occupiers with no one shooting at them is likely to be even more glaring than it was in 2006. Finally, if something seems too good to be true, invariably it isn't. An article appeared in the Washington Free Beacon, a neocon giveaway paper in Washington, D.C., noting that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was going to ask Israel to return $75 million to the U.S. Treasury because it had violated the terms of the agreement made last year between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in which, in exchange for a record $38 billion gift of U.S. weaponry over the current decade, or $3.8 billion annually, Israel would agree not to ask Congress for additional funding. Well, did anyone expect Netanyahu to keep his word? Of course not. But would Washington make him give back the extra $75 million? Not if Congress had anything to say about it. On Monday, the White House announced the Trump administration will not stand in the way of the additional defense assistance funding to Israel added by Congress and won't hold Israel to its pledge to return such funds. Said R.C. Hammond, a State Department spokesman, to Fox News, the administration is committed to ensuring Israel receives the assistance that has been appropriated by Congress. Well, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham pushed the appropriation of the extra funding because he was furious at the terms of the memorandum of understanding negotiated by the Obama administration. A photo accompanying the story showed a smiling Graham sitting at a table with Republican billionaire megadonor Sheldon Adelson on his right and Democratic billionaire and megadonor Haim Saban on his left. Both men have an arm around Graham. He is their boy. And now, a word from AIPAC.
That's where AIPAC comes in. AIPAC has worked with Congress for decades to counter economic warfare against Israel. In the 1970s, we helped Congress combat the Arab League boycott by preventing American companies from complying. That boycott ultimately failed. In the 2000s, we urged Congress to make ending boycotts against Israel a condition of free trade with the United States. The Arab states of Oman and Bahrain agreed, and America now monitors their compliance. And today, we are succeeding again. As trade talks take place between the United States and the European Union, strong bipartisan majorities in Congress have set a clear standard. EU nations boycotting Israel risk forfeiting the benefits of free trade with America. This wouldn't happen without you, your support for AIPAC, and your commitment to advancing the U.S.-Israel alliance.
Indeed. That's from AIPAC, which gives Congress its marching orders on Israel's behalf. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with some disturbing stories out of Palestine. Israel continues to turn the screws of military occupation against the Palestinian people. They seem to get away with everything, and their cruelty seems to know no bounds, even when it comes to offending international communities by destroying projects funded by them. Their strategy of making life unbearable so that the Palestinians will somehow leave their land has been, is, and will continue to be a colossal failure. In fact, under incredible duress, the Palestinian population is increasing while the Jewish population is diminishing throughout historic Palestine. But Israel wants the land, is taking the land, and we not only do nothing about it, we fund it. We begin with a story out of Bethlehem, the destruction of a brand new internationally funded school the day before school started. Here's how the story was reported by Shireen Kalel in Mondo Weiss. Israeli military jeeps came barreling down towards Jubet al-Dib's first and only primary school late Tuesday night, terrifying locals who had been finishing preparation for the school's grand opening set for the next morning. Soldiers shot tear gas and rubber-coated bullets as they cleared the way for bulldozers and flatbed trucks brought in to take the school. The school, located between four Palestinian villages on the outskirts of Bethlehem, was built with caravans on a concrete foundation by local authorities and international NGOs partnered with the European Union, hoping to mitigate the myriad of challenges facing students in the area. Israeli students quickly cleared the area with crowd control weapons, and within an hour of the soldiers' arrival, the caravans had been loaded up and taken away, along with the tables, desks, construction equipment, and everything else other than the concrete foundation, bathrooms, and tiny chairs brought for the 7 to 9-year-olds that were expected to attend their first day of school the next morning. The only other schools in the area, Hattin Primary and Secondary Schools for Boys and Girls, located in the middle of Tamara Village on the outskirts of Bethlehem City, is actually a shoddily refurbished home rented by the Palestinian Authority to serve the children of four local villages. The landlord lives in a home on the upper floor. If it was not for the faded cartoon paintings etched along the wall of Hattin School, one might think they were passing a car garage instead of a main educational institution in the area. The front of the school opens to three large garage-like doors. Each door takes up an entire wall of each room, leaving the children's cramped classrooms exposed to the main street some meters away. In the first room, boys and girls sat nearly shoulder to shoulder on their very first day of kindergarten. These children lived closest to the school, so they were given priority to attend class there. The rest of the children from the surrounding villages have to travel up to 6 miles away. There are no school buses, and many people living in the rural village, not connected to electric grids or main water lines, have no means of transportation and little money to afford daily trips to and from the school, leaving most of the children with no other choice but to walk. The classrooms are not anywhere near large enough to hold the students it serves, which is only a small fraction of the children in the community. Standing inside one of the classrooms in the basement of the home-turned school, the principal explained that 20 students were supposed to be taught in that tiny room. It is too hard to study in this kind of room. It makes it so the students aren't able to focus very well because they look at the conditions, she said, motioning to the small room around her, whose peeling walls were decorated from floor to ceiling in art projects made by the children, an attempt to brighten the dreary room. The new school, which would have served more than 60 children, was built to help relieve the situation for the students, but while the old school is located in Area B under joint Palestinian-Israeli control, the new school was located in Area C, which falls under full Israeli control. Any construction in Area C, which comprises more than 60% of the West Bank, requires a building permit, 98.5% of which are denied. The European Union and the Palestinian Authority had hoped to get the school approved retroactively, as the two bodies had been pressuring Israeli authorities to approve a master plan for the villages, which would also allow them to be hooked up to electricity grids, water mains, garbage facilities, and more. A Palestinian employee with one of the NGOs involved in the project, who asked to remain anonymous, told Mondo Weiss that building the school in Area C was a calculated plan. We are persuading the planning regime, the employee explained, referring to the pressure put on Israel to approve the master plan. We can't leave Area C. This is the Palestinian Authority and the European Union's policy. Otherwise, it'll be confiscated later for settlement expansion. Having a school in Area C is a way to further support a master plan and to convince the community not to leave. A spokesperson with the Israelis Coordination for Government Activities in the Territories, the body charged with administering the occupied West Bank, said the school was confiscated after stop orders were issued days previously. However, local activists said stop work orders were only issued to the concrete bathrooms built next to the caravans. The bathrooms were left while the caravans were confiscated. Palestinian children sit and wait on the remains of their school that was destroyed by the Israeli forces as activists set up a tent for teachers to conduct classes in that day. The morning after the confiscation, the children still came. All 64 students who expected to start class at their new school gathered on the barren concrete foundation as part of a symbolic protest. The children sang the national anthem to politicians, activists, parents, and teachers before receiving brand new backpacks to take home with them. For their second day of school, some of the children will return to the dilapidated school in the village, while most will continue taking the long walk to schools in other areas where they are treated differently and made fun of, both from being from a rural area and from often showing up late in sweaty, dirty clothes from the long walk. While very young, the children told Mondo Weiss they understood very well what was happening around them. "We came to school and found the school destroyed," one young boy said. "It's the first day of school, and we are just sad because the soldiers took our hope." That was an article from the news service Mondo Weiss, describing the Israeli destruction of a brand new school for Palestinian children the day before the new semester began. Our next story involves the outrageous arrest of one of the most beloved activists working in the very dangerous area of Hebron, perhaps the most active area of settler violence. It is yet another example of the collaboration of the Palestinian Authority with the Israeli military. Indeed, the PA has become an arm of the occupation. Here is Mondo Weiss's account of that incident. Palestinian forces arrested Palestinian peace activist Issa Amro for the Facebook post he published condemning the Palestinian Authority for detaining journalist and radio director Ayman Kouazmi the day previously. Kouazmi was detained by the PA days after Israeli forces raided and shut down Freedom Radio in Hebron on accusations of, quote, incitement. Immediately following the forced closure of the station, Kouazmi took to social media, blasting the PA for being unable to protect its citizens and calling for Palestinian Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah, as well as Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, and Hebron Mayor Kamel Hamed to resign. "This is happening in front of you. My message to President Mahmoud Abbas, Prime Minister Rami El Hamdallah, Hebron Governor Kamel Hamed, and other officials is to submit their resignations and stay at home because they are unable to protect the media in Palestine." His statement read, translated into English by the International Middle East Media Center. This media network is in an area that is under the complete control of the Palestinian Authority, yet they remain silent and cannot protect us. "We have nothing to do with incitement. We try to deliver the message of the simple people in need to the officials. We try to be the voice of the voiceless. And that is why we keep getting attacked and harassed," 3 days after the post was published, PA forces showed up to arrest Kouassmé. Hearing of the arrest, Amro took to social media himself to condemn the detention. He called for the media to put a social focus on Kouassmé's arrest and suggested an official complaint against the PA be taken to the Europeans. A journalist was threatened by members of security forces on the back of the news of the arrest of Amin al-Kouassmé, part of Amro's post read. I'm asking all journalists to publish the news. It's not a rumor, it's true news. Secondly, if any journalist is facing the same situation, please talk or get in touch with me. We are going to document all violations of the law and tell the Europeans about it. According to a press release published by Amro's organization, Youth Against Settlements, he was initially called in for an interview with the PA over the post, but was subsequently arrested during the meeting. Locals seem to think the threat of taking the case abroad was the red line Amro crossed in the eyes of the PA. Amro, a very well-connected activist based in Hebron, has given speeches on behalf of Palestine, the United Nations, and other well-respected international institutions. Immediately after Amro's arrest, Amnesty International published a press release calling for the PA to immediately and unconditionally release Amro. It is outrageous that a prominent human rights defender has been arrested simply for voicing his opinion online. Criticizing the authorities should not be a criminal offense. Iso Amro's arrest is the latest evidence that the Palestinian authorities are determined to continue with their repressive campaign against free speech. Magdalena Mughrabi, Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa at Amnesty International, said, "We have seen an alarming escalation in the Palestinian authorities' clampdown on freedom of expression in recent months. Instead of continuing to set up their efforts to quash dissenting voices, the Palestinian Authority should immediately and unconditionally release Issa Amro and stop harassing and intimidating activists and others for daring to speak their minds freely." Mughrabi continued, referring to the escalating crackdown on freedom of speech and press under the PA. In July, via presidential decree, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas passed the Electronic Crimes Law, which law allows for heavy fines and detentions of anyone critical of the Palestinian Authority online, including journalists and whistleblowers. Amnesty documented that the law is also open to be used against regular citizens posting on social media or simply retweeting news or the posts of others. Under the new law, anyone charged with breaking the legislation by posting something that could be deemed a disturbance to public order, national unity, or social peace could be sentenced to imprisonment and up to 15 years hard labor, according to Amnesty. According to the Palestinian Center for Development and Media Freedoms, MADA, the law is a flagrant violation of the principle of the right to privacy, promised by Palestinian Basic Law 32, which guarantees that any violation of any personal freedom, of the sanctity of the private life of human beings, or any of the rights or liberties that have been guaranteed by law or by this basic law shall be considered a crime. In addition, Palestine has agreed to the terms of several international conventions which guarantee and protect freedom of opinion and expression, of which the Electronic Crimes Law is in violation, foremost of which is the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, according to MADA. Due to these facts, MADA, similar to AMRO, called for member states of the convention to take all legislative and other measures in line with international standards against the new law as well as the Palestinian authorities' actions. In July, at least 10 journalists were summoned by the PA for interrogation, while in August, they arrested at least 6 journalists. In addition, the PA has closed down or blocked access to at least 29 websites, most of which are the websites of news publications. In addition to Gwasme's criticism against the PA that sparked the arrests of himself and Amro, Gwasme also blasted Israel for closing the radio station, a common practice by Israeli forces who have closed down more than a dozen news agencies, publishers, and radio stations since its crackdown on incitement started in the fall of 2015. We are not surprised by his savage behavior of the Israeli army and its collaborators. They want to silence us. They are all conspiring against us, he wrote, prior to his arrest by the PA. If helping the people and aiding them is considered incitement, then we are proud of it. Our main role is to deliver the message and appeals of the ordinary people to the officials. As for incitement, let them show us one instance of incitement. All our programming is archived, and we have nothing to hide. That was an account of the collaboration of the Palestinian Authority with the Israeli military in the subjugation of the media through the arrest of Palestinian activist and voice of the people, Issa Amro. And now on to our feature presentation, which today is Telesure's Abby Martin's interview of journalist Max Blumenthal. We often turn to Max Blumenthal on This Week in Palestine because of all the journalists in the Western media, Max Blumenthal has the best credentials to report on what is happening in Palestine and Israel. His book, Goliath, is a vivid and disturbing account of life in Israel, and his account on the 51-day war in Gaza reflect the time spent in each place and the integrity of his resources. Here is Max Blumenthal, recently interviewed by Abby Martin on Telesure's Empire Files.
Today I'm sitting down with Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist and commentator on Israel and the struggle in Palestine. He's the author of the award-winning book Goliath and the recently published expose, The 51-Day War, where his on-the-ground reporting in Gaza in the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge documented the harrowing reality of Israel's war crimes. I wanted to find out what he discovered during his coverage of the war and how it relates to the current uprising in Palestine. Max, can you break down what's happening right now and what people are calling the Third Intifada?
It doesn't fit within the parameters of what we know an intifada to be, which is a nationwide uprising directed by political factions. What we're seeing is a completely disorganized rebellion by a generation of youth who've grown up after the Oslo Accords, which laid the basis for a two-state solution and the U.S.-led peace process was established. And they've grown up in that reality. It's a reality of separation, exclusion. They've witnessed the destruction of the Palestinian grassroots. All of the institutions of Palestinian life, especially in East Jerusalem, have been virtually eliminated. In the West Bank, they've been folded into the PA and the NGO infrastructure. And they see very little opportunity or hope. The occupation has deepened and tightened. They watched a 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip and felt helpless. They've seen the Palestinian de facto leadership in Ramallah, the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, coordinate security with their occupier and sick their Palestinian forces on them, carrying out raids, for example, at Bir Zeit University. And so this generation has decided to act on its own. This has been building for a long time. But now that this generation has come of age, they're lashing out at their occupier. They're going out and demonstrating at the friction points of occupation. So, for example, at the checkpoint at Beit El in Al Bire outside Ramallah, There are regular demonstrations. They're throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at heavily armed soldiers around Nablus, which is a site of settler terror, and especially in Hebron, where settlers, the most radical settlers in all of Israel-Palestine, are embedded in the old city and regularly terrorize and prey on Palestinians. They are carrying out attacks. There are knife attacks inside the Green Line, which is a symbolic act. And what they're doing is they're sending a message that as long as we're occupied, there's going to be a price. You're not going to be safe, and you won't be normal. As Netanyahu said recently, we are destined to live by the sword. But in Tel Aviv and Haifa and all of the cities inside Israel's interior where most of the Jewish population lives, it will be like we're in Europe. Or as Ehud Barak, a former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, said, we'll be a villa in the jungle. And when young Palestinians enter the villa with knives, with rocks, or whatever they have, they are reminding Israelis, you're not a villa in the jungle. You're the jungle in our villa. You're in the Middle East, and you can't just put up a wall and pretend we're not here.
Why is the Al-Aqsa Mosque center to this political struggle?
First of all, Jerusalem has been separated from the West Bank and Ramallah thanks to the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords provided the basis for a separation regime. The separation regime was manifested in the separation wall, which separates occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank. The Israelis proceeded to destroy all of the key Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem, like Orient House, which was supposed to be the future seat of a Palestinian government that would govern from the capital of East Jerusalem. That all moved to the other side of the wall, to Ramallah. And then every other institution proceeded to collapse. The only thing left was the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the symbol of Palestinian nationalism in Jerusalem. To me, it's much more about the Palestinian national struggle than about religion. But in Israeli society, you've seen in Jewish Israeli society a development where religious nationalist class has risen in power. They're really reorienting society into a theocratic dominionist direction. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a symbol because it's the Temple Mount. There were supposedly Jewish temples there 1,300 years ago, and they aim to rebuild the temple as a symbol of the replacement of Israel as a state governed by civil law with a more theocratic, openly Jewish state, what I would call JSIL, or the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant. The Knesset and many of the ministers in Netanyahu's government are religious nationalists. The pressure on Al-Aqsa increases, and the pressure on Jerusalem increases, and the conflict, such as it is, takes on a religious dimension and begins to resemble a clash of civilizations instead of a struggle over rights and land. The Al-Aqsa Mosque has been almost completely encircled by Israeli settlers, and they've accomplished that through brute force, throwing Palestinians out of their home and replacing them with religious ultranationalists. They've built tunnels under Al-Aqsa Mosque, which actually have destabilized the infrastructural integrity of the old city of Jerusalem. And now they're beginning to prevent Palestinians from praying at Al-Aqsa for the first time so that Jewish religious extremists can ascend and conduct their own kind of prayers. And so all of these disruptions have destabilized Jerusalem. Then you have 300,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem living under occupation with constant pressure from settlers. They're living among the most extreme elements of Israeli society who are armed. They themselves are not armed. The youth have been, traumatized by this environment, and they're lashing out. And the friction point is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, Al-Aqsa Mosque was where the Second Intifada began when Ariel Sharon ascended with his surrounded by security forces, and it led to a complete bloodbath.
Well, the siege on Gaza no doubt plays a role in the anger throughout all of Palestine. Max, you were on the ground and you outline some harrowing details in your book about what you found. Outline the devastation that took place during last year's 51-day war.
I immediately, as soon as I entered Gaza, went to Shijaiya, which was the, you couldn't really call it a neighborhood. It's more like an entire city east of Gaza City that had been wiped off the map by Israeli artillery and pretty much every mode of destruction available to the Israelis. Every house I went to there, they weren't really houses, they were ruins of homes, and speaking to elderly women and entire families about having their family members summarily executed in front of them, interviewing paramedics who found a woman, an 80-year-old woman in a chicken coop who had hid there for 8 days living off of chicken feed, pulling dead families, entire families out of homes and finding that they couldn't pull them out because their limbs would fall off and having to bring in bulldozers to bulldoze bodies into mass graves, interviewing the Rujela family about fleeing tank fire and leaving their severely disabled daughter on the road in her wheelchair and then finding her in her wheelchair a week later riddled with bullets. These kind of stories were what I heard day after day. I mean, everywhere I went, I was walking through a real-life horror film, and this was the Palestinian experience in Gaza for 51 days. It was like a sequel to the movie Saw. How do you deal with that psychologically? That's the question we have to ask now, because the humanitarian situation is worse than it's ever been in history. The United Nations Relief Works Agency predicted that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020, and it's currently uninhabitable. People are trapped there. Most can't leave. And who are the Jewish Israelis, the 300,000 who participated in this operation? How do they think? Netanyahu was reelected in a surprise to a lot of Americans after Operation Protective Edge. You have to go into a very right-wing eliminationist mindset in order to justify what you did, and it's Netanyahu is able to cater to that. Just the amount of violence I witnessed was only the beginning of a nightmare that's continuing through the present. The Gaza Strip has 80% of the residents of the Gaza Strip, 72-80% are refugees. So it's a warehouse for surplus humans, and for the first time you actually are seeing, for example, a wave of child suicides. I interviewed the father of Salem Shamali, who was killed on camera.
Guys, this one.
The hand.
He was looking for his wounded cousin, and he was killed.
Yalla, 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 yalla. Shada la ilaha illallah. Allah.
It was reported on by international news, and the family, it really affected the family to find out, you know, our son was killed, and we found out because someone emailed us the video of his killing, and we only knew it was him because we recognized the sound of his screams. So Salem's father told me that his other sons and children are making amanat, which is a unique term that doesn't really have a clear English translation, but it means like their last dying wishes. So the violence, of course, is on, you know, it's a physical violence, but there's a psychological component to it. The Israelis threatened to bomb the main hospital, the Al-Najjar hospital in Rafah, and so everyone had to pour out of the hospital, wounded people, people missing limbs, and the entire medical staff, and the only place left was the Kuwaiti hospital, which is actually a 20-bed OBGYN and geriatric clinic in the center of town that's completely unequipped for this kind of disaster. And the doctor I met there, Samir Holmes, told me that he was treating amputees on the floor, that his own medical staff was coming in dead, and that the carnage got so bad that he had to order ice cream coolers from local shops to store the corpses of infants. And this image that is widely available of four infants in white death shrouds in an ice cream cooler, I think is iconic. It's the image that distills the entire sensibility of Israeli society at this point and how little value they place on Palestinian life.
And as Israeli forces were using the Hannibal directive and kind of indiscriminately shooting even on their captured soldiers. Al-Qassam Brigade was changing its tactics over the last couple of years. We saw it act pretty differently during the 51-day war. Talk about what happened there.
The tactics of Al-Qassam as a guerrilla force in face-to-face confrontations with Israeli soldiers was untested. And the Israeli military underestimated their capacity. Through the tunnel network in the south of Gaza, the Al-Qassam Brigades and Hamas had been able to import some heavy weaponry, like the kind of weapons that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon had. I mean, Cornet anti-tank missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, lots of AK-47s, and some heavier machine guns that could be carried. But more importantly, the Al-Qassam Brigades imported the tactics of Hezbollah. They may have received some Syrian training or indirect Syrian training through Hezbollah. And this proved very effective when the Israeli military invaded in July the neighborhood of Shujaiya. You saw basically local teams of fighters situate themselves in tunnels in and around Shujaiya and then wait to ambush Israeli soldiers who had initially entered in very lightly armored vehicles, which were supplied by the U.S. military as surplus and were left over from the Vietnam era. And some Qassam sapper teams were able to destroy these vehicles by simply planting charges on them by hand, explosive charges by hand, displaying a lot of bravado. But the most important tactic, I think, that was put on display in Shujaiya was the willingness to engage Israeli troops at less than 15 meters away for prolonged periods of time. During Casled in 2008-2009, Al-Qassam would stage hit-and-run attacks, and they learned from Hezbollah that you don't hit and run, you stay in the fight, because that neutralizes the two strengths that Israel has over every other military in the Middle East, air power and artillery power. If you have soldiers engaged in face-to-face fighting, you can't provide air support or artillery support because you'll kill them. The Israeli military found it, this is the Golani Brigade, its most elite special forces, who have very little experience, actually, in real fighting, really motivated, well-armed forces. I mean, they're more used to beating up on farmers and stone-throwing kids in the West Bank. They found themselves losing their lives at an alarming rate. Injuries were coming in by the dozens. And I think it was the night of July 14th. I might be getting the date wrong. They decided to retreat and carry out one of the most cowardly military maneuvers in modern military history. Retreat in armored personnel carriers as fast as they could to the border of Israel and Gaza, and then unload with what amounted to half of the artillery pieces in the Israeli military and blanket the entire area with 120 and 155 millimeter howitzers. And that's what resulted in the destruction of Shujaiya, was actually the defeat, or the moral defeat, of the Israeli military. The most famous operation was at Nahal Oz. This was later on in July. A team of Al-Qassam fighters with GoPro cameras attached to their helmets attacked an Israeli military base. The goal was to capture soldiers, I think, which would have been a game changer, would have given them a lot of leverage in negotiations, might have even ended the war. But they managed to kill almost every soldier they encountered. They lost only one member of their team and made it back into the tunnel with one of the soldiers' rifles, which was upheld as a trophy at the end of the war. This operation demonstrated, or had two effects. One was it demonstrated that the Al-Qassam Brigades aren't interested in attacking civilians, because Nahal Oz is also, the base is part of a kibbutz. I mean, they could have gone and killed civilians, but they chose to engage soldiers. And Al-Qassam General Commander Mohammed Deif stated clearly that we're attacking soldiers while you bring the roofs down on the heads of our civilians. And the second effect it had was securing almost unanimous support in Palestinian society, including among, Fatah supporting people in Ramallah for the concept of armed resistance. You're used to seeing your relatives and your friends and even experiencing yourself humiliation at the hands of Israeli soldiers, especially if you live in Jerusalem or one of the areas where settlers are. And for the first time, you see young Palestinian guys dressed up like commandos, giving the Israeli military a bloody nose and taking the fight to the enemy. I mean, that had a strong psychological impact in Palestinian society. And so now there's a lot of criticism of Hamas, dissent against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. But I don't know anyone who would question the importance of maintaining a kind of guerrilla force that's highly militarized and is there to fight the Israeli military.
The Israeli parliament has approved a law that imposes stiff penalties on people convicted of throwing rocks at moving vehicles. Under the law, stone throwers could face 10 years in prison and up to 20 years if it is determined that they intended to seriously harm the occupants in a vehicle. The lawmaker who sponsored the legislation said that one-third of arrests in Jerusalem are connected to stone throwing.
So the government's going to great lengths to crush resistance. The latest measure is the 20-year prison sentence for anyone throwing a stone. Max, talk about the significance of stones in Palestine and why you think this law was passed.
In this case, this law was passed by the Israeli parliament, a very extreme law, and members of the Labor Party and the opposition supported it. It wasn't just right-wingers who were determined to throw young people in jail for almost their entire adult life for throwing a stone. It shows how threatened Israeli society is by the smallest, most minuscule iterations of Palestinian resistance, even symbolic resistance like stones. And now it's become a symbol of resistance and telling Israelis that they're not welcome. Why are you throwing rocks at a soldier who's wearing a Kevlar vest and is protected against 7.62-millimeter live rounds? The Israelis are responding now with unprecedented measures. I went to the hospital in Ramallah in July and interviewed a doctor who told me that he was treating dozens of gunshot wounds to the legs, and that Israel had a shoot-to-cripple policy. And he provided me with documentation, which pretty much showed that soldiers were cracking down on demonstrations with live fire to the legs. Not only that, but some of the bullets were what Palestinians call ton-ton bullets or dum-dum bullets, which are expanding rounds. So they'll bounce around inside your limbs and expand and really cripple you for life. The Israeli this bill to jail stone throwers for 20 years is complements another measure put into place by the Israeli military and police, which allows even members of the Israeli police to shoot demonstrators with 22 caliber rounds from Ruger rifles. The 22 caliber rounds are less likely to kill. They're more likely to cripple. They shatter bones. They often bounce around inside your body. This is standard practice now. Standard practice to shoot demonstrators with live weapons.
The Palestinian, unfortunately, instead of building a Gaza Strip as the Singapore of the Middle East, they choose the terror path.
They want to pile up as many civilian dead as they can, because somebody said they use, I mean, it's gruesome, they use telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. They want the more dead, the better.
In the letter, and I'll read it to you, you say the formerly populated areas will be shelled in Gaza with maximum firepower. The entire civilian and military infrastructure of Hamas will be destroyed entirely. And then you say those who insist on staying will be required to publicly sign a declaration of loyalty to Israel.
People might be surprised to learn that Netanyahu is actually not the most right-wing Israeli government, that it's actually just gotten more and more right-wing over the last decade.
Benjamin Netanyahu, I've been saying for the last 2 years, exists at the hollow center of Israeli politics. I talked about the generation of Palestinian youth, the post-Oslo generation, and how they've developed. But within Israeli society, there's been a parallel development with the post-Oslo generation that's extremely radical, sees no hope for, you know, a two-state solution or a peace process. Their approach to the Palestinians is that there's no partner for peace and that they only understand force. This is a generation that's adopted a very strongly Jewish identity and a belligerent Jewish identity, as opposed to the identity of Israel's founding generation, which was based around a concept of Israeli nationalism, which was racist, but which allowed for some place for Palestinians or Arabs. The kind of sensibility and identity this generation has adopted leaves no place for anyone who's a non-Jew. And this generation is embodied by the current justice minister, Ayelet Shaked. That bill we talked about to punish stone throwers for 20 years, that was her baby. She ushered it through the Knesset. She's young. I think she's our age. She's very telegenic. She's very popular in Israeli society. She's not a settler. She comes from a core Israeli city. In many ways, she's kind of a carpetbagger. And she is genocidal in her approach to Palestinians. In fact, she called for genocide during Operation Protective Edge, for exterminating Palestinian mothers to prevent them from giving birth to little snakes. She's in charge of the Justice Ministry. And you look at the direction of Israeli society. You just look at the polls from Israeli Democracy Institute that show that a majority of youth state their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab or a non-Jew, that a majority of youth favor a kind of one-state apartheid solution. In 2011, in this poll, a plurality of Israelis stated their support for placing Arab citizens of the state of Israel in internment camps during wartime. Three-quarters of Israelis in a recent poll reported by the Times of Israel, three-quarters of religious nationalist Israelis declared their support for the full ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel, the 20% of Israel who are Palestinian citizens. And 80% said that they boycott Arab businesses. So you look at the direction of Israeli society and you have to conclude that there's no hope for change from within, that those of us on the outside who want to see a different outcome than perpetual conflict can't work from inside Israeli society. We don't have a place for convincing people. There has to be pressure from the outside. And the pressure has to start here, because it's Washington and the U.S. government that has funded radicalization in Israel. They've paid for this whole project, because every time Israel builds settlements, every time they give money to the settlers, every time the education ministry brings kids to Hebron to see the settlements, every time that they decide to teach kindergartners about the Holocaust and scare kindergartners into an authoritarian mindset, and every time they assault Gaza and get as much time as they want, the U.S. is there to pay for the whole project and to rearm them. And so they're rewarding radicalism in Jewish Israeli society, and that's really ultimately why this trend is continuing.
That was journalist Max Blumenthal, interviewed by Abby Martin on Telesure. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To hear the program later in the day — we realize that 8 a.m. on Sunday morning is awfully early for some — or to listen at any other time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Back to BCFM's politics show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. My kids will live forever, but your kids will die. The ultimate aim of the transhumanists who see the mind hooking up to the internet. A white bucket fire bomber leaves a bucket on a London tube this morning. But how many Syrian and Yemenis has our taxpayers' money killed this week? And we follow up on last week's 9/11 special by looking at some further aspects of the mother of all false flag attacks, also the Israeli Armed Forces' Talpiot program, T-A-L-P-I-O-T. It's for getting their soldiers and spies into key positions of chief executives of high-tech corporations that even our military have to trust and rely on right across the West. And as we trailed a bit earlier, we take a look at transhumanism's links to fascism with the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, David Livingstone. He started by deconstructing myths about Western civilization and ended up identifying high-tech firms such as Google as representing a shop window for ideas of modern fascists. Where a privileged elite are above the law and someday hope to become gods. Our sister show Daleks back on BCFM 93.2, we hope, at noon on Tuesday. This week is that interview with David Livingstone in full, and also another look at Charlottesville and the statues. That's Daleks at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/Daleks. Or, if you can't wait, or if it doesn't work this week, as it in the last couple of weeks, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, a bomb in Parsons Green this morning. It's been called a bomb, although I heard someone on Five Live describing it as more of a kind of thrump sound. It didn't actually go bang, he said. And there was a lot of fire everywhere at the end of the carriage.
Well, obviously, we're just getting the information about this through.
It's called a fairy light bucket bomb, according to the Telegraph, and it could have killed dozens if it had detonated properly. So what they're saying is that it didn't detonate properly, or as your term you like to use, maybe it was jarked.
Jarking means that a bomb has been interfered with, possibly by security forces or whatever. So one, if you jark a bomb, you can jark a bomb to go off, jark a bomb not to go off. In other words, the perpetrator plants the bomb but doesn't realise that the bomb's been interfered with by somebody else.
So they may blow themselves up.
You can jark a bomb to blow up the perpetrator.
Could you jark a bomb to do something like this?
Well, it sounds to me a fairly unsophisticated device. That's all I can say. I used to teach in the school right next there where the girls from Lady Margaret's school have been injured, I understand. I'm sorry to hear that because I used to teach in that school and I know the place really well.
Anyway, experts say the bomb was apparently reliant on a string of fairy lights attached to a battery. Appeared to have malfunctioned several stations before it was due to explode. The crude device, packed into a builder's white bucket and carried in a little cool bag, exploded on a packed London underground train shortly before 8:30 a.m, injuring 22 people, but thankfully nobody killed.
Well, yes, thankfully nobody killed. I mean, you have to ask yourself the question, the pattern of this. I mean, there is no suicide bomber, clearly. Whoever left the bomb left it and walked off, which, of course, is a more rational thing to do than committing suicide. But then it doesn't... If you don't tell people you've done it or why you've done it, then there isn't much of a political point to it either. I mean, obviously, as you mentioned in the intro, people in Baghdad, for example, whenever they go out, can expect somebody to bomb them. And that's the way it's been ever since we invaded in 2003.
One thing everybody knows about the London Tube is that all the stations and all the trains are absolutely cameraed up to the maximum, everywhere cameras. Yeah. And yet I'm looking around, still haven't seen any pictures of the person who apparently left it there.
Well,
you would think that would be absolutely crucial. The first thing the police would do, get pictures of this person and make sure the whole world knew and could identify.
Well, I understand they claim they have a suspect, but they've not released a picture of them. So we will just have to see how this develops. Don't forget that, as you know, on this show we cover frequently the idea that terrorism is not entirely a spontaneous creation. There's usually some hidden hand behind terrorist attacks, often intelligence services, foreign intelligence services, whatever. But this one sounds to me like it could just be a random person doing randomly stupid stuff. But I don't know, and okay, we're just going to have to wait for the investigation.
So the police have identified this suspect, we see from the Metro newspaper, by trawling CCTV. So is there any point in actually not putting out that picture?
Well, if they may not want to warn the person that they know who it is.
The person knows themselves.
Well, I know, but I mean...
What's the point in that?
Well, I mean, there is a point in that. I mean, it depends. The police sometimes do not want people to know that they know who they are. But I'm not...
So you could be going for supper with the suspect and not even know it because they haven't...
Yeah, well, I mean, if they've got a picture of somebody planting that bomb on CCTV... then it ought to be fairly straightforward to find out who they are.
To identify them, to make the photograph public, and then get every mind in the country looking at that person saying, I know who that is.
Yeah, it depends. Police sometimes do that and sometimes don't. It's an operational decision for the police. Sometimes they get it wrong. And don't forget, underlying all of this is our suspicion that Western intelligence services are heavily involved in the promotion of Islamist terrorism. They certainly are inside Syria. They certainly have been in the past in other places.
People reported seeing a fireball and a wall of flame in the train and people covered in blood.
Well, I mean, whoever did it, what's the political point of this? And maybe there is no political point. There could be just some of mental health issues. But the creation of a terrorist threat in order to try and steer politics in a direction that the manipulators want it to go, I'm afraid that's very definitely on the agenda. And certainly the attacks during the election campaign and the one previously, the people involved were well known to the security forces, and various elements of the attacks just don't smell right. And we know that NATO intelligence services have an intimate relationship with jihadist terrorists in this country and elsewhere. That's why Britain was seen as a haven for these forces from the 1980s onwards, because MI6 was the lead agency on Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan.
Like Afghanistan, you mentioning there, and Yemen and Syria. Hmm. This is the death. These sorts of deaths are an everyday occurrence. So I see that this week. The United Nations is saying, well, they've been very careful not to make sure there's not a single person who could possibly be involved in the fighting in Yemen is included. But they're now saying that there's 5,000 people, all civilians, definitely civilians, have died, an absolute minimum.
Indeed, and of course we hear virtually nothing about it on our TV, even though we've been bombarded for years with how evil the Syrian government is. They're bombing their own people. How awful.
This is Yemen,
I know, but the Saudis have invaded Yemen with our support and are killing loads of civilians, and we hardly hear anything about it because we're implicated. We're implicated in killing people in Syria as well. Planting bombs on the London Tube.
Yeah, Jeremy
certainly
Corbyn
doesn't.
Is suggesting that there's some kind of blowback involved in these attacks.
Well, there may or may not be. The point is we've got to find out the facts about what this particular incident represents.
What are we doing exactly in Yemen? Because our military is involved, isn't it? The RAF particularly.
Yeah, well, there's British military personnel based in Saudi Arabia helping the Saudis with their war effort.
Targeting civilians.
Yep, definitely. I mean,
what's the point of this war?
Well, the Saudis aspire to being hegemonic in their part of the world. They want everybody dancing to their tune. The Saudis are our allies, and we work with them to frustrate the Syrian government, for example. So the Saudis have provided the money, the SAS provided the training, and the Saudis also recruited lots of people from across the Middle East, including from their own prisons, to fight inside Syria. I've mentioned this before on the show, but it's worth mentioning again. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, when interviewed on French TV some years ago, said he was approached by British officials who said, we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. So we're implicated both in the arms struggle in Syria and in what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen. British military personnel are involved. I'm not a pacifist. Those people are running a big risk of somebody deciding that they ought to die. Perhaps they should die.
We were talking about Nazis within the British Army, or at least neo-Nazis, and two British soldiers have been charged now with terror offences and being members of a neo-Nazi right-wing group. The soldiers were arrested the week before last in the UK, where a fourth was held by the Royal Military Police in Cyprus. This is in the Daily Mirror. Two British soldiers charged with terror offences, alleged membership of the banned neo-Nazi far-right group called National Action. It's been described as anti-Semitic and homophobic, but now we actually have charges.
Well, we'll have to see when it comes to court what we're actually looking at here. Don't forget, in Operation Gladio in the past, the intelligence services are encouraging all sorts of different kinds of terrorists so that they can then either let them carry out their terrorist attack and therefore frighten the population, or, alternatively, capture them and put them on trial and demonstrate how efficient they are at capturing people. That's clearly what's been going on with the FBI in the United States. 95% of the people sentenced to prison in the United States for terrorism offences are completely entrapped by the FBI.
Well, this illegal
the
group,
other 5%
this illegal group
dead.
National Action, apparently has around about 100 members.
Yeah.
West Midlands Counter-Terrorism Unit and Welsh Extremism Counter-Terrorism Unit Wales Extremism Counter-Terrorism Unit carried out the arrests with East Midlands Counter-Terrorism Unit. Gosh, lots of counter-terrorism units there all getting together. And Alexander Deakin, 22 years age, from Birmingham, and Mikko Verelium. I'll put a link up to this on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, in Brecon at the army camp, and also Mark Barrett, 24. He's been charged with membership of this group. They said he'd been also charged, Deakin particularly, been charged with possessing documents useful in committing or preparing an act of terrorism, distributing a terrorist publication, and inciting racial hatred.
Well, the least you could say is that if you're going to be a member of the British Army, you shouldn't be a part of these organisations. And the same would go for police officers. And, you know, it's necessary for these people to be rooted out. I mean, as you know, not that long ago, a German soldier was captured and put on trial, or was going to be put on trial, for creating a false identity as a Syrian refugee, under which false identity he was going to carry out a terrorist attack in Vienna airport, which would be blamed on Syrian refugees. That chap is now in custody and is going to go on trial in Germany. But one has to wonder what the level of manipulation is here. We know in the past that NATO intelligence services have created terrorist incidents in order to try and steer the population in certain directions. I'm not saying that's what's happened here, but I mean, obviously the National Action has been infiltrated by the state. That's how they've managed to identify these people.
Okay.
The question is the state manipulating National Action?
Interesting, another story this week, and it'd be nice to hear whether you think this is fake news or not. And this is on the Press TV, the Iranian channel. The United States airlifts ISIS-Daesh terrorists in Syria for the second time in a week. For the second time this week, a helicopter operating under the US-led coalition has transferred members of the Daesh terrorist group in Syria's eastern Deir al-Zor province, a UK-based monitoring group is saying. Now, Martin, what do you think about this? Is this fake news?
Well, it's coming from...
It's pretty explosive, isn't it?
Yeah,
rescued the top ISIS commanders.
It's coming, as I understand, from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry here. It's a single guy based in Coventry. And they've been regarded in the past as very much propaganda by the West. So if they're saying this, it's quite interesting. But I also understand that the Russian military have said that they want answers from the Americans about this. And they're saying that the US military has denied that they've done this. But the Russians have said, well, we want to hear something from Trump about this because we don't necessarily accept that he knows what's going on here. And, of course, the point that's been made all along by the Syrians, the Iranians and the Russians is that ISIS has been receiving support from from Western intelligence services. That's what the Iraqi government believe as well.
Well, talking of
so
Trump...
That's just what they believe.
Talking of
what
Trump...
What people choose to
Martin,
believe and listen to this is up to them.
There's been a bit of a Twitter spat between Donald Trump and the Metropolitan Police today.
Yes.
Trump assuming that this is an Islamist attack on London, and the Met saying quite politely, we don't know who the suspects are, so it's a bit difficult to say.
Maybe Trump knows more than we do, because if CIA, for example, were trying to taste us up and get us all frightened of Islamists, they may know more about this attack than
but
we do.
Bizarre, just isn't as, it? Just as in the Metro, Martin, they're saying they do know who this. They do have a suspect.
Yes, but they don't know what the suspect's politics are. They don't even know whether they're a Muslim or whatever. They've got a suspect.
They've got a face, that's all.
That's all. And, of course, Trump is just presuming it's clearly a Muslim, blah, 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 like
this,
he does.
To the Metropolitan Police, put that face out there. We need to know. If we're walking down the street and we see this person, whoever it is, that's put this fairy light bomb, whatever it is, on the London Tube, surely people have a right to know. What possible reason is there not to share that?
It's an operational decision for the police whether they put a suspect's face out or not. Sometimes they get it wrong, but there's legitimate reasons why they might not want
it's only a suspect, surely. The main thing is...
No, they may already know where he is. And they may even know exactly... They may be preparing to arrest him.
They may be sort of hiding around the corner if
they've already identified the person, then putting their face out gives them a warning that they're going to be arrested. If they've already identified them and they're preparing to arrest them, they don't want to put their face out there because then they'll know they're going to be arrested, won't they? I'm just presuming. I don't know. I'm not privy to the police's thinking about this. But there are legitimate reasons why they wouldn't put the face out there.
OK. Any other thoughts about international stories for this week?
Well, international stories from this week, what can I think of? I read a lot all the time, and I'm just trying to think what's... I mean, obviously, there's the ongoing North Korea business and the latest missile... flying over Japan and all the rest of it. The potential for that to just slide out of control is obviously there. There's moves to the BRICS meeting in China, as they're talking about trying to create an alternative currency system for the world. The Venezuelans have stopped accepting dollars for their oil, which may be a straw in the wind. And, the potential for things to run out of control is very much still
okay,
with
let's
us.
Let's talk about North Korea anyway, briefly. Yes, apparently it could get as far as Japan. It went a bit further than Japan. Should we be really worried? I mean, we hear this wall-to-wall on the mainstream press, North Korea
well,
all the time.
The fact is that the rhetoric by the Americans of threatening to attack North Korea, I mean, it's not, and the extra sanctions that were agreed in the UN Security Council with the Russians and the Chinese, the obvious response to that by Pyongyang is just to carry on throwing their rattle out of the pram, quite literally, because they haven't got anything else to do. I mean, threatening them isn't going to make them stop doing what they're doing, quite clearly not. In fact, the more you shout at them, the more likely they are to do this stuff. The only thing that's going to stop them doing it is if there's some comprehensive agreement to stop threatening to invade them. And since every 2 years, the Western powers and the South Koreans have a massive exercise where they pretend to invade North Korea, it's not surprising that the North Koreans presume that they're going to be invaded, especially when they look at what's happened in Iraq and Libya and elsewhere. So it's very difficult to see how they're going to be made to behave themselves. What threats are you going to make to them which are going to make them stop doing what they're doing?
Here's a question.
They're not going to take any notice,
are
they?
Here's a question for you. Which is the most corrupt country in the world?
Well, according to who? Transparency International?
Well, Brazil, the Brazilian president, is facing racketeering obstruction of justice charges. That's after they got rid of Dilma Rousseff. Yeah. This is Michael Turner has been accused of racketeering and obstruction of justice. He acted as a leader, apparently, of a criminal organisation, according to a statement posted by the chief prosecutor, Rodrigo Janot, on Thursday. That's yesterday. The prosecutor stated his gang, made up of senior members of the party, all allegedly taken $190 million in bribes in return for contracts at public companies.
Well, so he's
every new president they have in Brazil is just as corrupt.
Rousseff, who's been removed through judicial coup, even their enemies accept that she's not actually personally corrupt, and the evidence against her and against Lula is largely fabricated, in my view.
So this is actually a sort of self-harming by the judiciary?
What it is virtually all the non-PT politicians in Brazil are totally corrupt. PT has got some corruption involved with it, but less than the others. They've been the situation in Brazil is rather unfortunate, because Brazil is a very big country, potentially a swing country, a part of the BRICS group, and I'm afraid both Brazil and South Africa are being destabilised by Western powers because they want to mess up the potential for the BRICS to, you know, develop alternative currency arrangements and so on. And there's going to be more and more of this as we go forward. And the potential for this to lead to a crash is always there if there's misjudgments. And, you know, if you start dashing sanctions around on everybody, let's just presume, for example, that the sanctions on Russia had worked and the Russian economy had been pushed into the down the drain. Well, that would have pulled down all the rest of the world's economy with it, because they're a big economy, and if they go down, we go down with them.
Well, we talked about 9/11 last week in Afghanistan, and a few weeks ago there was an announcement that 4,000 US troops were going to bolster their presence in Afghanistan. This week it's quietly crept up to 6,000 troops. What is going on? Why are these extra troops needed in Afghanistan? Could this be an indication of something else going on?
Well, it's essentially Trump was talking about getting out of Afghanistan. The generals are now in charge of the policy, and he's been forced to change his policy and to send more troops to Afghanistan. The fact is, they used to have up to 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. They're still unable to defeat the insurgency, and 4,000 extra US troops in Afghanistan is not going to make any material difference. The purpose of the US being in Afghanistan is to keep the Chinese out, to prevent the Chinese getting access to the raw materials. There's quite a lot of raw materials.
So the Chinese would go in there?
If the situation stabilised and became peaceful, the Afghanistan...
Doesn't this imply the Americans intend to ramp things up?
Yes, they do. Because the Chinese One Belt, One New Silk Road project is that they want to try and build infrastructure across Eurasia, which will allow all of these countries to develop. And they're going to put in state-of-the-art trains, pipelines and stuff like this. Now, that very much relies upon peace. So if these wars are settled in this arc of conflict across Central Asia, then the Chinese project can go ahead. And the obvious way for the Americans to prevent that going ahead is to make sure that these wars just drag on and that there's no development, and that the Chinese proposals to develop the region on a peaceful basis are constantly thwarted. The Indian government are taking a pretty obstructive relationship to the Chinese at the moment. And this is all because the Americans have encouraged them to do so. And
let's just take a look at South Korea for a minute, because you've got a feel for these people. They're kind of caught in the middle, really, aren't they? A very prosperous country, very good education system there. But the South Korean leader, Moon Jae-in, seems like a man who can't stop saying yes, even though he was elected, effectively, to slow down US influence. The opposite is happening.
Yes, and of course...
And demonstrations on the streets, tens of thousands of people on the streets.
That's right.
We're seeing very little about that on the news.
Well, I mean, in the run-up to the election, he said he was going to get rid of the THAAD missile system, which the Americans have put into South Korea, and that's because that missile system can do nothing whatsoever to protect South Korea. If the North Koreans decide to nuke South Korea or even attack South Korea conventionally, that missile system is worthless. Its only real purpose is to put pressure on China and Russia, because that missile system is a first strike system, or it can knock down a retaliatory strike. And the withdrawal from the ABM treaty by the US after 9/11 and so on has led to a destabilization of nuclear geopolitics, and this is very dangerous. But no, they're no longer relying on mutually assured destruction. They're talking in terms of they can use nuclear weapons to win a war. And there are people openly saying in the US that we should nuke North Korea.
Well, this is actually this whole, whole
bonkers,
argument.
But that's
this whole
saying.
Argument applies to Europe too, doesn't it? Because the Germans are actually now saying, several of the senior German politicians fighting this election are now saying, right, we'll vote for us and we'll get rid of all the US nukes from Germany.
Yes, but at the same time,
there's not
the,
a bit of fuss made.
No,
about
no,
that,
no,
is
no.
It?
But at the same time, the Poles and the Romanians are happy to have, or their leaders are happy to have, these anti-missile missiles on their territory, which of course is much more threatening to the Russians than, you know, essentially retaliatory stuff based in Germany. But I mean, the whole point is that the nuclear war fighting is now being openly discussed in a way that it hasn't been for a generation.
Well, the other side to this, of course, is the effective break-ins in the embassies over in California by the Americans of the Russians. Now, the Russians are just saying, well, we can't quite believe you're doing this.
Well, that's right. And they've also said that RT will have to register Russia Today, for which I do regular things, is going to be made to register as a foreign agent. And they're going to, they're going to be put under surveillance, etc. Tension is being ratcheted up here. That's no doubt about that. And I don't think anybody wants an all-out nuclear war, but you could end up with one just because people are basically shooting their mouths off. And words are weapons, and it might be better for everybody just calm down a bit and talk in a calmer tone of voice, and we might be able to resolve some.
But surely at the back of this, there is actually a wish to escalate things from the Pentagon.
There is, yes, and
what? So why?
Well, because basically it's a boondoggle. These generals who run the Pentagon, when they retire, they go onto the boards of the companies that supply the stuff to the Pentagon. The US taxpayer pays for it all, and it keeps everybody in private school fees and all the rest of it. And that's what's underlying all of this. And there's an unwillingness to compromise with the Russians and the Chinese to develop a world order that works for everybody. That's obviously what's going to happen in the end, one way or another, if we survive. But there's definitely a group based in the US of oligarchs who do not want to accept changes in the world order, which means that they will have to compromise with others. They're not used to compromising. They don't like the idea of it, and they're determined that they're going to prevent it.
So has Kim Jong-un outmaneuvered the Americans this time, do you think?
Well, he's basically got his back against the wall. I mean, they basically said, we want a regime change here. Now, at that point, he's under no pressure whatsoever to give up his nuclear weapons, because if he does, then he's going to be regime change. He's going to end up with a bane upon his
own,
like Gaddafi.
Deterrence, isn't it? I think.
Well, that's the reason why we've got them. Perhaps I'll tell you what we could do. We could flog him our Trident missile system, use the money to pay for schools and hospitals, because we don't need it and he does, and it's a free market. Why don't we do that?
Not sure about that, Martin.
That wasn't one of my better ideas.
Let's do a bit of a follow up anyway on our discussion last week with Ian Henshaw on the whole some of the details of the September the 11th attacks. One of the things we didn't really talk that much about was the way that it's affected things today in terms of policy, particularly with what you would call Islamophobia, even though, of course, if you go back to September the 11th and start looking at that, it doesn't look as if this is some kind of bin Laden operation at all.
Well, I mean, obviously we covered this very extensively last week. The purpose of this is to demonise Muslims, to demonise Al-Qaeda as the culprits, and therefore to justify intervention willy-nilly in any country that the US deems to be an enemy. And, you don't have to be a genius to work out what the motivation is here or what we've ended up with. And all these years later, we're still on this disastrous road to nowhere.
Where do you think we are heading, though? Because surely there's more and more pushback and resistance around the world saying, well, actually, that we don't really want to go along with this plan of the US to dominate.
One of the problems with a failing hegemon like the US So they've been had a dominant.
Can you compare this to the fall of Rome? I mean, you know, or the.
Well, you can compare it to anything like that. I mean, all empires rise and fall. They reach their kind of, you know, their peak point, and then
the Roman emperor started, you know, coming up with crazy ideas, doing all sorts of nutty stuff,
yeah.
And eventually the whole thing just collapsed, didn't
well,
it?
Well, yes, but I mean, and the classic analysis of this is by Paul Kennedy, U.S. academic, and it's imperial overstretch. Eventually, all empires grow so big that they can't, in fact, contain, you know, the resources, and they haven't got the resources to. I mean, you know, this is the U.S. empire is effectively the biggest ever. I mean, they want full spectrum dominance. They want to control the whole planet, and even the Japanese and German militarists in World War II didn't think they were going to control the whole planet. They just wanted to control their bits of it. The U.S. Power elite aspires to control the whole planet, and because they've got such big aspirations, that's why they keep doubling down, even when the logical thing to do would be to draw in their horns and get a bit more moderate, be a bit like the Emperor Hadrian, who decided he was interested in art and culture and architecture, and he built Hadrian's Wall. He built a similar wall in Libya, and he's basically saying, well, the Roman Empire is as big as we want it to be. We don't really want to invade Scotland because there's nothing there. Even if we got there, what would we get out of it? Nothing. So we're just going to build this wall here, and we're going to live behind the wall, and the Scots from the on the other side. Well, they weren't the Scots in those days picked.
But there's,
on the
are
other
there
side
any,
of the wall. They can,
are
they can,
there any Hadrians can, around in the US
well,
administration?
No, there aren't. This is the problem. The aspiration is to control everything. It's a bit megalomaniac. You know, the US is, in fact, a relatively small country compared to the rest of the world. It's a tiny percentage of the world's population, even though they've got an awful lot of the resources and the wealth because of the power that they have in controlling the world's reserve currency and so on. But I think they've been driven slightly mad by their own power, so that instead of rationally assessing what it is they can and can't do and where they want to go in cooperation with others, there's a continuous attempt to try and basically get the all or nothing. So for example, when Trump was in India the other week with Modi, who's the Prime Minister of India, and they'd done a big deal to buy loads of weaponry from the Americans, and Trump was joking that by the time the weapons were delivered, they'd be demanding more money for the weaponry than they'd already paid. So he was joking with Modi that, you've already agreed to buy this weaponry off us for price X, but we're actually going to make you pay price Y because we're America first.
Is that sounds a bit like HS2.
Well, indeed, it's just, well, what it is all of this money being spent is cash registers going ka-ching for certain individuals and groups who are making
it
money.
It does seem like, almost like a religion, this money nowadays. Also, Donald Trump, Martin, in the run-up to the election campaign, was saying, you may find the Saudis were behind the 9/11 attacks.
Well, he's gone quiet on that, hasn't he, after he went to visit them and was prancing around waving swords with them all. I don't think you can take anything Donald Trump says too seriously, although he did point out, for example, that the buildings couldn't have collapsed through fires on 9/11. There's a quote, people will perhaps put a link to his quote on the show page, where he was saying, well, I build these buildings for a living, and I went round the World Trade Center in 1993 after the bombings there, which were actually carried out by FBI informants, and he said the building didn't come down even though there were bombs in the basement.
Is there any real terrorism out there, or is this all
I think there are
done by the state?
There are angry
the state or private bodies outside the state.
There's more than one thing going on, but a lot of so-called radical Islamist terrorism of the Sunni Salafi variety, very definitely run by the Gulf Cooperation Council secret services and our own secret services. And that doesn't mean that there aren't individuals with ill intent. There are, but they're not really that dangerous. They get dangerous when they've got resources and backup.
I know, I had a fascinating conversation earlier this week with David Livingstone over in the US about transhumanism, and he was quite clear that these people are in power, they've got a lot of power, they've got fantastic amounts of money, and I asked him about the sort of personality behind these people, because with the idea of transhumanism effectively being to when people can become gods, that's what he says, but the idea is that you as an individual, as humans, can create a kind of artificial intelligence that then goes on with a life of its own. So let's have a listen to what he had to say about the psychology behind people behind and involved in this transhumanist movement.
What they believe is that people are stupid. They believe that they are privileged. They believe that they believe that the basis of their privilege is that they have the mental fortitude to of a Nietzschean kind of interpretation. They believe that that people, because people are mentally weak, even spiritually weak, they need to invent phantoms like gods, a god or a religion. And to them, they believe that a person with true character is able to acknowledge that there is no truth and face the abyss. So this is basically what Nietzsche talked about. What typically happens there is, and I write about this in my book Transhumanism, because the scream, the painting, the scream is supposed to be a representation or portrayal of that realization. So the first realization is panic, is the scream, is the horror. But for these guys, it's getting beyond that initial fear, and they think that they have the strength to be able to just accept that there is no right and wrong, that there is no purpose to our existence. So you can basically do whatever you want.
Well, but hang on, but even children know the difference between right and wrong. I mean, a 3, 4, 5 year old.
Absolutely. They're arrogant. This is the nature of evil. They are choosing to reject right and wrong to justify their own actions, but they just build it up in an elaborate philosophy to make it seem like it's well thought out.
Well, I think the mention of Nietzsche there is interesting, of course, because he was the famous 19th century philosopher who said God is dead. He was the idea of the Superman, that we, human beings or certain group of human beings were going to be the leaders of the future, and they were going to determine what should happen, etc.
I mean, surely human beings have always been leaders. What's different about Nietzsche?
Well, I mean, Nietzsche is influential in philosophical circles, even by those who don't agree with him, because he pushed to the limit these kind of ideas. Although I think that in actual fact there's an awful lot of gobbledygook in Nietzsche as well. It's not actually that logical. It's literary rather than philosophical in some respects.
Can you just in a nutshell, what did he say?
Well, he basically most famously said God is dead. In other words, what he was saying is that, and he was right about this, is that what would increasingly happen as the 19th century went into the 20th century is that traditional ways of thinking about the world would gradually be eroded away, and that people would no longer believe in God as the old chap in the crowds.
He was right, wasn't he?
Well, he was right, yes, and that's why he was influential, because he was pointing in a direction of something that society was evolving in that sort of direction.
But having said that, I mean, there's probably lots of reasons why there's less faith around now than there was, and that's partly because it's in those days. I mean, for example, if you didn't go to church on a Sunday, you would have your collar felt. I mean, you had to go if you go back to medieval times, didn't you?
That's right, yeah. And of course, gradually, some societies more than others. I mean, Britain is a relative. Britain is one of the most secular societies in the world. I mean, of course, plenty of religious people in Britain even now, but a majority of young people now say that they have no religious belief.
Well, there's a theory of evolution that's been very, very powerful too. That's even though, of course, it's a theory, it's treated by many, including in many schools, as fact.
Well, look, that's another topic, to be honest with you. I mean, if we're talking about what you have got in the US in particular, if you think of Leo Strauss and the neocons, Leo Strauss was very influential, Ayn Rand, even more influential. They are basically philosophers of selfishness. Both Leo Strauss and Ayn Rand said, there's an elite that really knows what it's doing, and we are that elite. The masses are just idiots, and they're there to be manipulated. They're to be told one thing. That, in other words, Leo Strauss was all in favour of religious beliefs for the masses, but not for the leaders. And essentially, these are, you know, fascist ideas. And somebody like Ayn Rand, for example, has been enormously influential. Virtually all US politicians claim that they love her and found her books incredibly revealing, and she's the most important philosopher ever. And basically, she's a journalist turned novelist of very limited intellectual capacity who's now dead. And her basic philosophy was, look after number one, and that's what you should do, and all these other ideas from Confucius, Jesus, Buddha, Karl Marx, all a load of rubbish. Look after number one, that's my philosophy. And, of course, even if it is your philosophy, you shouldn't tell people. Genghis Khan used to tell them that he was fulfilling God's will, because that's what you tell people. But it's a bit silly, these people, because they talk openly amongst themselves about their own elite ideas of them not manipulating the masses. And you thought, well, actually, you've just told us what your game is. So that's not really that bright, is it?
So is this just about kind of dressing up selfishness,
yes,
wickedness,
yes,
stealing other people's property,
yes,
bullying, subjugating people with some kind of sugar-coated pill?
Yes, it is. And of course, it's also geared towards a particular audience. The people who love Ayn Rand, Greenspan, who ended up as head of the Federal Reserve, who used to be a great friend of hers and so on, is that they are the elite. And they, because they are the elite, they like the idea that the elite should run things and that the masses are stupid and need to be manipulated. And that's very attractive to elite people. But that's got an awful lot to do with their social position. As Karl Marx pointed out many years ago, social being determines consciousness. If you are the elite, then you believe that the elite should be in charge, and that's all good. But of course, if you're not part of the elite, that doesn't really add up, does it?
Yeah, a bit worrying that this can sort of crystallise out into some kind of positive philosophy, which is taken seriously by mainstream
press.
What's
extraordinary to me is that this is taken seriously by intelligent people. Ayn Rand is not a philosopher, but she's presented by many wealthy Americans, inside the political structure and in business, as some kind of guru. And in actual fact, this is drivel. It's low-level stuff. But they actually think that it's profound. And that's really worrying.
What's also worrying is the way that the mainstream media often treats it as profound.
Well, the point is, she's become a very influential person, as has Leo Strauss as well, in influencing the neoconservative
movement. What David Livingstone
Strauss
was saying
has got,
there?
Strauss has got more intellectual credibility than Rand. They're both dead and they're both wrong.
Is it true that what David Livingstone is saying there, that people are stupid enough maybe to believe this stuff? I mean, that's what their arrogance in a way comes from, this whole thing of saying, well, people are stupid, we can manipulate them, look at us.
Well, I mean, people can be manipulated, we know that. But I think that they are deluded if they feel that they can control the processes that are setting in motion. It's the whole, like we were talking earlier about the geopolitical situation. I don't think anybody in the Pentagon wants a nuclear war in a Dr. Strangelove way. What they want is a society based around war, with everybody totally terrified, and essentially a police state that people accept because they're frightened of the consequences of letting go of it, and lots of money being spent on the things they want it spent on, which keeps them happy. But of course, the problem with warfare is it's not something that can be planned like that. Nobody wanted World War One. Nobody on any side was looking for a war, but it happened anyway because of everybody's stupid attitudes and unwillingness to think outside the box.
And no doubt it can happen again.
Indeed.
I'm sure there are some people out there thinking, what on earth has this got to do with anything in the real world? And one of the next questions I asked to David Livingstone was about this precise, I mean, how can we pin this down? And he was saying that actually the transhumanists have strong links to the intelligence services and also to groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, that the whole Salafist ideology, which is supposed to be part of Islam, was actually dreamt up by an English spy.
I got inspired by the program that I took, the college course that I took, and basically everything was coordinated into 3 years. And so the first year was from the Bible to the French Revolution, and the French Revolution to the 20th century, and then the 20th century. So kind of followed that. So when I wrote The Dying God, it's basically from the earliest times to pretty much the French Revolution, and it follows the history of the occult from Babylon to Greece. And then Islam is an important factor as well. Islam also got affected or infected with the occult, producing the mystical tradition of Sufism. Then I explore the occult bases of the Renaissance, and then the development of secret societies like the Freemasons, Illuminati, Rosicrucians, which ultimately led to the French Revolution. And then after that, my second book is called Terrorism and the Illuminati. And there I explore in the main organization that is being used to carry out acts of terrorism in the name of Islam is an organization called the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is an organization which basically is ultimately an occult organization, a Masonic organization. So I explore amazingly intertwined with some of the most important elements of the Western occult tradition, particularly they follow the Salafi tradition, which was founded by a guy named a Mason named Jamaluddin Afghani, who was an English agent, who was also happened to be one of the important teachers, according to K. Paul Johnson, of H. P. Blavatsky.
She was the founder of Theosophy. Yeah, a very important organization. Yeah, in fact, we've got just next to the BBC here in Bristol, we've got the Bristol Theosophists blazoned across one of the big buildings there.
Right. It's hugely important. I mean, she's really pretty much the godmother of modern occultism. She's considered the godmother of the New Age movement as well. So after that, I wrote Black Terror, White Soldiers. There's the aspect of the occult tradition which has really been missed by, I think, almost every scholar is what's called synarchism. And this really develops with René Guénon, who temporarily was a member of the Theosophical Society as well, too. But he's the one who developed this stream called traditionalism. And his most important student was Julius Evola. And Julius Evola is pretty much the godfather late 20th century fascism, occult fascism, and behind what's called Operation Gladio. And after that, I did transhumanism. And then my latest book kind of goes back to the Black Terror, White Soldiers book, which again explores the history of traditionalism to follow the history of late 20th century fascism, particularly its development in the United States with the Patriot Movement, with the basically far-right conservative movement in the United States, which ultimately created the movement behind that had Donald Trump elected.
Well, there's an awful lot in there. And you know, there's...
Synarchism, what about them?
What did you say?
Synarchism.
Well, I've never heard of synarchism until he just mentioned it. So, as I say, there's an awful lot in there.
But one of the things, I mean, this is a theme that comes up on this program quite a lot, is this whole theme he's addressing in this book, Black Terror, White Soldiers, where the idea is that actually there's a whole, that happens to be white people behind this whole idea of the black terrorist outrage.
Well, look, I mean, taking it down to a more basic level, the state engages in manipulations of the population. He mentioned Gladio there. That's absolutely historical. People can carry out a search and they can find what Gladio was. They won't find everything about it because we still don't know everything about it. And I'm quite sure that there are some occult elements in all of this. We know, for example, that the Nazis had strong occult leanings. People like Himmler sent expeditions to Tibet to look for the Holy Grail and this sort of thing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everything is connected to everything else in some kind of conspiratorial way. What you've got is powerful groups using their power in order to try and extend their power. And it's been going on for a very long time. It's been going on in medieval history, modern history, and right up to date.
What about the Muslim Brotherhood, for example?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood, it's interesting you should mention the Muslim Brotherhood, because in actual fact, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudis are not on the same page at all, which is one of the reasons why the Qataris and the Saudis have fallen out, and why Sisi is aligned with Saudi Arabia rather than with Qatar, is because the Muslim Brotherhood are regarded by the Saudis as a threat. The Saudi ruling class is essentially a corrupt Salafist elite based on Wahhabi links, which the British encouraged. So the British encouraged the creation of the Saudi state based on Salafi Wahhabi ideas. And those Salafi Wahhabi ideas are neither Sufi ideas. They're very hostile to Sufism. So it's funny you've mentioned Sufism there. Sufism is much more diffuse and interesting than Salafism, frankly. But the Muslim Brotherhood, who are Salafi as well, but they are hostile to the Saudis, and the Saudis are hostile to them because the Saudis don't want mass movements of any kind.
Okay, they're elitist. Getting to the nub of some of what David was saying, he talks about the Pinay Circle and also mimetic warfare, the idea of using memes and the discordians. So let's have a listen to that final clip now.
We don't need to name them the Illuminati in our time, but there's enough evidence. In fact, it seems that one of the more powerful groups in our time has been Le Cercle, or the Cercle Pinay, and that's really the founded by a couple of Bilderbergers, and has really been the parent organization behind much of the fascist international. I mean, a well-known anarcho-capitalist would be Murray Rothbard, and he's really one of the godfathers of the modern libertarian movement. What's interesting there is that he developed with his partner Lou Rockwell, who used to write for Ron Paul, by the way, they developed what they call an outreach to rednecks strategy, which was basically to appeal to racist sentiments in the U.S. as a Trojan horse to carry forward their neoliberal ideology, or what they call anarcho-capitalist. These groups and thinkers are very closely aligned to the leading transhumanists, particularly a person like Robert Anton Wilson, who's very much the godfather of, in some ways, the godfather of transhumanism, particularly for his role in the popularization of a very strange tradition called Discordianism. So my latest book, really, it kind of wraps up all these trends that I've been following. You have the very close relationship between fascism, transhumanism, and Discordianism. And so Discordianism is what it sounds like. It's a belief that life is chaos. It devolves out of chaos in the belief in chaos magic. And chaos magic is really the modern form of occultism today. We've really seen it play out in the election of Donald Trump with the creation of fake news, popularized by various online communities, particularly 4chan, which is basically populated by Discordians. And so it's what they call mimetic warfare. It's based on their agenda of rocking the boat, of deliberately confronting what they call political correctness by being deliberately offensive, by inciting hatreds and prejudices, is all part of what is basically their form of magic, and which is basically is chaos magic, which is ultimately tied to esoteric fascism. And that's the times that we're heading in these days.
That's David Livingstone there, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. A final clip from him. Martin, he's actually talking about the origins also there and the strength of this group, Le Cercle, which we've studied a few times on this program. We've mentioned them anyway, which is a sort of coordinating body, it seems. And people like the far-right MP Jonathan Aitken was chairman of that for a while. And I wonder what you make of that final contribution he made there. So a lot of it is about what he's calling mimetic warfare, which effectively what we talk about, I suppose, on this show is psychological warfare.
Yeah, you could call it fourth generation warfare. What I find interesting, I mean, that's the first I've ever heard of this guy or his clips, is that he's got a lot of interesting stuff there, but he's mixing stuff up. I mean, Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell are libertarians. I don't agree with them. Murray Rothbard's dead, but I mean, but Murray Rothbard, in fact, is a libertarian with a very hostile view of the state and the state's role in warfare. how he can be lumped in with people like Leo Strauss, who are neoconservative warmongers.
Well, I don't think he quite did that. But what I think he's saying is that they're trying to divide society up into lots of different types of people and then control each group.
Well, that's right. And that's certainly, if you think about, you know, coming back to down to earth with Gladio, the intelligence services were manipulating all sorts of left-field groups, right-field groups, mainstream politicians were also being manipulated. That's what they want to do. They want to fragment society so that they can divide and rule. But you can't just lump all these different things in together. These different people have got different ideas. And I'd have to read his books to see what he's saying.
Maybe you could do that. But I think what he's saying is that it's controlled centrally, that people who appear to have opposing views are controlled centrally. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook. Hopefully, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour MP for Bristol South, Karen Smith.
Welcome, friends, to an edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, incomes, debts, those coming down the road for us, and those facing our children in the years ahead. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and that, in a way, has prepared me to present this last week's economic highlights for your interest. I'm going to begin with what's been on everyone's mind who watches the media or listens to them, namely these enormous storms, first in Texas, then in Florida, with more apparently churning their way up from the Caribbean and threatening to bother us yet again in serious ways. I'm not going to talk about the natural dimensions of it. You've heard that story. I'm not going to talk about the heroic efforts to rescue people, which are indeed stimulating and provocative in the best sense. I want to talk about what the media generally doesn't talk about, which is the relationship between our economic system, capitalism, and these storms and what they mean. So I'll start with a few dimensions and then build up to what I think is the big question. First, the few dimensions. One of the things that got a lot of play, and I'm glad it did, was what we call in economics price gouging. The two biggest examples were when Delta Airlines jacked up the price of a flight out of one of these areas from $400 and something to $3,000 and something, simply taking advantage of the desperate need for people to get out of the way of a desperate storm. There was another picture that flashed across the media of a Best Buy store where a case of bottled water was being sold in excess of $40. In other words, sellers of commodities were taking advantage of a natural disaster, so it was called, to really squeeze people at a moment when they had no choice, when they were desperate. It's an example of how markets work. Markets are a part of our system. And markets, as you all know, depend on the laws of supply and demand. And if the demand becomes desperate for people literally trying to save their lives, well, then you can charge, quote, what the market will bear. And that's what they did big time all over the place. Not just those that were recorded by the media, but thousands of examples that were not, or at least not in a general way. What is this about? Well, you do have, and I'm apologize for my fellow economists, since many of them do this, you do have those who believe that profit is holy, or at least as holy as anything can be, and that therefore profit can never be questioned. So since the people who gouge in moments of crisis make more profits by jacking up their prices, well then, that must be reasonable. And indeed, my fellow economists, more than I would like to admit, have been busy in recent days justifying this unbelievable behavior. But I'm also proud of the American people, at least in the sense that the bulk of the comments that I could see did notice that if you jack up the prices, if that's how the market works in a time of crisis, making it more difficult for all of the people suffering to cope with a crisis situation in order to benefit the profits of a relative few, that might not just be the best way to manage an economic crisis or a natural disaster. And maybe that suggests that the market and the system of profit-driven decisions in business isn't the best way to go. Maybe not just in emergencies, but more generally. Then I noticed another aspect from the capitalist system. Some years ago, when big, profitable insurance companies noticed that storms kept coming, particularly to Florida, they withdrew from the state. This is another aspect of the capitalist system. If you can't make profit, don't do it. Which then opens the question, what happens to the people who need whatever it is you do that you're not doing anymore in the way of Allstate and other big insurance companies that withdrew? Well, lots of little companies came in to catch hold of the profits that could be made. There it is, the profit system, by setting up small insurance companies to fill the vacuum left when the more profitable big ones withdrew. And the problem is, an insurance company is only as good as the money it has to make good on the claims of the policyholders. And if the insurance company is small, it may not have... Oh, you can see where this story is going, can't you? Well, you're right. That's where it's going. The little insurance companies that now do the bulk of the business in Florida don't have enough money to cover their claims, not themselves and not in the reinsurances that they themselves take out to cover the situation. So the fear growing in Florida now is that the government will in the end have to backstop, because that's how a capitalist system solves the difficulties of private profit by fixing it with public money. That looks like what it's going to happen. Either the taxpayers of Florida will have to kick it in, or the people making claims won't get what they thought they could get when they bought the insurance policy. What a way to handle natural emergencies. But these are the little stories. I want to get to the big one. And this is actually more applicable to the Texas situation than to Florida because of the way the storm evolved. The amazing thing about the Harvey storm in Texas was the absence of preparation. The governor of the state of Texas goes on the television during the crisis to answer reporters' questions, why did you not order an evacuation of all of the areas lying in the path of this horrible storm so they would get out of there and not be threatened in their lives and in their homes. And his answer was to scoff at the reporter and say, you don't seem to understand. If I said evacuate, the highway would immediately be filled with millions of cars who would they be unable to move. Well, this is a none too subtle way of saying, I can't handle it. We're not prepared. I learned later that the ground in Texas around the area that was hit is spongy. It absorbs a certain amount of water, and then it can't anymore. In other words, you have to prepare. And now let's look at the economics of preparing. Who's going to do that? The developer, eager to build tracts of homes, eager to build shopping and industrial malls, eager to build roads if you're a construction company. They don't want to hear about all the difficulties. They want to get the contract, build the house, bill the people who buy the house, and leave. The long-term effects are not part of their profit calculation because they'll be out of there once the development is undertaken. Gee, they might then push against the government holding up the project until they can decide what's safe. The government mandating walls and barriers to protect. The government deciding to move a production site from one location to another to be less risky. And that would give the government power. And private capitalists don't like to do that unless the government is helping them. And these things don't seem to help them. We have a system that systematically underprepares. And that's true in Texas, and that's true in Florida. Because it's not privately profitable, no one is doing it. And the government, demonized by the very private profit mechanisms and institutions of our culture. The government is unable to raise the money to do these things. It's constantly portrayed as wasting money, as if intrinsically it was less efficient to do something in the government than it was to do it in the private sector. And let me be an economist for a moment. There's absolutely no evidence for this. There are as many examples of inefficient private production as there are of inefficient government production, and the same is true of efficiency. Besides which, how efficient is it to now have hundreds of billions of dollars, if you combine Texas, Florida, and who knows how many others coming down the pike, how efficient is it not to take the protective measures that could have and that should have been taken? One final word here. There is a society near where the storms hit that's different, that gives the government an enormous role. We're used to making fun of that society. It's called Cuba. So I want to read you from the New York Times on the 10th of September the following story, and I'm quoting from the New York Times on that day. Quote, while the Cuban response to the storm seemed to be a well-oiled machine, elsewhere in the Caribbean, the government reaction has been halting. Well, this is the New York Times language for saying the Cubans have a well-oiled system of preventing and protecting there because they're not driven by private profit the way we are. There's a lesson here, but of course, like all lessons, if you're not open to learning the lesson, well, then you won't. My next economic update has to do with something I have come back to over and over again, but I have to, because it's an ongoing crisis that's economic as much as anything else. It's the drug crisis, or more precisely, the epidemic of overdoses from opiates and opioids in this country, now running at the rate of 50 to 60,000 deaths from overdose per year in the United States. These are numbers that are staggering. I'm going to explain in a few minutes how different they are from country to country, depending on how the economy deals with this awful situation. But just to give you an idea and whet your appetite, I'm going to tell you a little bit later about another country, Portugal, not that far away, which handles its drug problems differently. Deaths per million can be measured and have been measured in the United States and in Portugal. In the United States, deaths per million, about 185. Overdose deaths per million of American citizens, 185 per million over these last 2 or 3 years. dying. In Portugal, how many per million? 3. Not 300, not 30, 3. How is it possible that in our country, 185 per million kill themselves by overdose, and in Portugal, which once had a very severe drug problem, has reduced it to 3? Well, I will come back and I will tell you. But first, let's talk about the economics of the drug business. Here are some of the businesses involved in drugs, in the whole drug epidemic, and so on. First, there are all the businesses that produce the drugs, that transport the drugs, and that distribute the drugs. Many of them are legal businesses, many of them are illegal businesses. But in terms of the drug epidemic, it really doesn't matter because they are a big business employing thousands of people, earning millions, if not billions of dollars, producing, transporting, and distributing it. Then there's a second group of businesses, those involved in the medical care and the medicines for people already addicted, because the number of addicted is, of course, much larger than the number that are dying from overdose of those drugs. Then there is the enormous cost of the criminalization of drugs, the enormous apparatus of police, of prisons. Someone once told me that a majority of the people in prisons, directly or indirectly, have something to do with the drug problem in the United States. We know from statements made by the Haldeman-Ehrlichman combo, those that are left, from the Nixon administration, that prosecuting African-Americans and young radicals for drug possession became a way of decimating that part of the population, denying them the vote, because if you have a felony conviction, you can't vote in many states, the United States, and so on. But prisons and staffing prisons and supplying prisons, that's another big business which might be harmed if you legalized or, better yet, solved your drug problem. It's a failure. We've had this drug war on drugs now for many years. It hasn't done very well, according to what I can see, the death rate from overdose being worse now than it has been in a long time. So we're not succeeding in dealing with it, and I suspect that the economic interests that have money to be made from this industry and have been making a lot of money from it are not a small part of why this war on drugs seems to be so horrible and unsuccessful. And then a last thing that just happened this last couple of weeks. The attorney general in the state of New Mexico, Hector Balderas, filed suit in court against the opioid-producing pharmaceutical companies for systematically misinforming and basically finding ways to sell their death-dealing drugs. He specifically singled out the following, and I thought you'd be interested to know. Purdue Pharma, Johnson & Johnson, Endo Health Solutions, Teva Pharmaceutical Industries, and Actavis. He accused them publicly of, quote, falsely representing and downplaying the highly addictive nature of the painkillers to doctors. In doing this, Mr. Balderas cited documents from the Centers for Disease Control. I won't repeat those all to you. I just want you to know that New Mexico is now the eighth state, to have its attorney general file suit against these or other companies alleging that they systematically did what? Made profits by distributing killer drugs, addictive drugs, to people in ways that directly violate the law. That's the charge that now 8 states have levied. Now Portugal. 2001, Portugal was suffering from major problem with opiate-type drugs, heroin and so on. And so they made a drastic decision. They would legalize drug possession. Basically, no more punishment. You don't go to jail if you're caught with heroin or a synthetic version of heroin like fentanyl and so on. You get a reference to a drug treatment center, and you may get a very small fine. The money accumulated through such small fines and in other ways is used to provide a countrywide program of drug counseling, psychotherapy, medication, and so on. Overdose deaths in Portugal are 3 per million, and in the United States, there are 185 per million. Something is working in one place, and something is not working in another. The big drug companies either didn't bother or weren't able to get the freedom to function in Portugal that they have in the United States. And I will keep talking about this crisis so long as the economics seem to dominate and keep that industry alive and growing in terms of its profits and in terms of the social damage it does.
And you're listening to Economic Update with Richard Wolff on listener-sponsored KPFA Radio 94.1 FM. I'm Mitch Jezerich coming to you from our studio in downtown Berkeley. And I need just this one moment of your time before we return to today's program. And return we will do, as Richard Wolff will be in conversation with Chris Hedges. That is something definitely worth staying tuned for. Now, KPFA is now in day 4 of an 18-day fund drive. This radio station does not air commercials, nor does it take corporate underwriting. The very reason that we are able to air Economic Update with Richard Wolff is because of the generosity of you, the listener, not because of some gift by Chevron or Walmart. Now, we have a good thing going at this hour on Fridays at 10 a.m. It has always been my pledge to you, in exchange of a financial pledge from you, to bring this vast majority of this radio program intact to the air, even during our fund drive. And I do it by asking you for what I like to call a pure donation. To donate to support this radio station. That's what you're doing. And to support this radio program. A donation that is reasonable for you. One that you can afford. One that you think this program is deserving of. And also a donation that you could feel good about. Because we all know that altruism is healthy. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge online, fast, it's easy, it's secure, kpfa.org. Or just give us a call. We have a room full of phone room volunteers. They're being altruistic with their time and their labor to this radio station. You can also honor them by calling in with your pledge. Now, our goal this hour is $3,000. If we make it, we will, the way we'll be able to bring this program again largely intact next week. And the way that we do that is everyone does what they can, according to their own means. So a $25 pledge will make you a basic member to this radio station. You may be one of those people that can afford a $200 or $500 or even a $1,000 pledge. Again, it's everyone according to their means. And if we get a lot of $25 and $50 and $75, and then somebody puts in a $500 or a $200 pledge, that's how we make it. And what we really need to do is average about $100 per pledge. But again, that's one person, $25 pledge, another person, $175 pledge. You know how it works. So the phone number again is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. We now return to Economic Update.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update. As we often do in this second half, I am very pleased to introduce to you my guest for today. The introduction will be brief, not because of any lack of material. It's in the opposite problem. There's too much. My guest is Chris Hedges. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for the New York Times. He's the author of Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. He is a speaker who crisscrosses both the United States and Canada and also is busy abroad. I bump into him from time to time. I've had the good fortune to do a few things together with him in recent years,
So it is an enormous personal pleasure as well as a treat, I believe, for all of you to have conversation with him about what's going on here in the United States and beyond that in the world. So welcome to our program, Chris.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, let me jump right into it, given what this program does, and ask you, where in the broader picture of what you see going on in the United States and beyond is the problem of the economic system? What we talk about on this program, I thought my viewers and listeners would enjoy how it looks from another perspective. From yours, you have broad interests, but in that, the capitalist system and its ways figure, and I'd like to hear you say a few things about it.
Well, since I've been tutored by your work, I think that Marx got it, that we're in the twilight stage of capitalism when, as Marx predicted, what capitalism does is essentially not only become parasitic but cannibalistic. So you've deindustrialized the country. You've thrust, and we know the figures, the official figures of unemployment, of poverty are fixed. You've impoverished the country, deindustrialized the country, stripped social services, and you have large corporations essentially consuming the very machinery that sustains the state. And the whole notion of the common good, of the commons, of any kind of government as a structure to foster and maintain community has been jettisoned by neoliberalism. And so you were watching in the Trump administration this extreme kleptocracy. And I'm not speaking about just the personal kleptocracy of Trump and his family, which is extreme, but the kleptocracy of corporations and hedge funds that seek to extract money. The education department, we spend about $800 billion a year on education. We have placed a lobbyist, Betsy DeVos, who has never even was an educator in the, essentially, who has this mantra that we're going to destroy public education and make it better. And they want that money. And they're getting it through charter schools, which we know do not perform in states like Michigan, where DeVos's foundation has set up numerous for-profit charter schools. We know it doesn't function better. We know it's a form of educational apartheid in the sense that they will refuse to accept not only poor students, students of color, but students with learning disabilities, students for whom English is a second language because they're more expensive to educate. They have a kind of for-profit model. They're completely vocational. They destroy teachers' unions. They bring in people who are ill-equipped to teach and essentially teach by rote. And this is just writ large now. So you have her brother, of all people, Eric Prince, attempting to privatize the war in Afghanistan. You have Bose Allen Hamilton, which gets 99% of its revenue from the federal government by privatizing intelligence, which, of course, where Edward Snowden came from. Right. And that fusion, by the way, of corporate access to all of our personal information and government access to all of our information. We have 16, roughly, intelligence agencies, and 70 or more percent of its work is done by private contractors. So that's the stage that we're in. You see in distressed cities, Detroit would be an extreme example, but any city really, where they are selling off their municipal assets, their sewers, their parking authority, anything, to try and pay back usury loans at high interest rates that they have had to take out of Wall Street, especially after 2008, in order to continue to have the city function. The main institutions left in most American cities, when they have them, are universities and hospitals. So I would say that presages a very frightening scenario, because not only is it not sustainable, but eventually it will lead to systems collapse. And I'm talking about the inability of urban areas to collect the garbage. You know, people can't pay their property taxes. So
in Detroit, they couldn't pay for the water.
Right, and so they do a hostile takeover, and they bring in somebody who poisons the families, including the children of the city, pumping toxic water out of the Detroit River because they don't want to purify it. I mean, that's I think Detroit is an extreme example of where we're heading.
All right. Let me push this. One of the symptoms of the capitalism, at least as it's developing here in the United States, is well known. It's the growing gap between rich and poor. It's been underway at least 30 to 40 years, a kind of rollback of what happened out of the Depression and the war. Here's the question that I think is on millions of American people's mind. How much further can this go before it reaches some point of intolerability so that people, or is that the wrong question to ask? In other words, this very stage, as you put it, of a capitalist decay or decline has with it the conditions that you might expect provokes a resistance. Do you see that? Or is it a wrong question?
No, and the elites are acutely aware of that, which is why they have militarized police forces, you know, handing military-grade equipment, including tanks we saw on the streets of Ferguson, 50-caliber machine guns. Most of these cops don't even know how to use these weapons. And the wholesale surveillance, which is a characteristic of any totalitarian society. As Hannah Arendt writes, you collect information on all of the citizenry not to seek a crime, but when you want to criminalize a person or a segment of the society, you have information by which you can use in order to justify, even though it's innocuous. And so the elites are well aware that there's blowback. What I worry is that with the complete collapse of the left in the United States, unlike in Europe, where there are kind of residual pockets, still communist, socialist entities, certainly atrophied. But ours were just destroyed in the name of kind of the war against communism. If there are anarchic uprisings, which I think there will be, then without vision and without a national kind of focus, i.e., I think your case and mine, that would be a kind of socialism, then they're easily quelled because they can be dealt with as individual brush fires across the landscape. And certainly all the tools of the state or the mechanisms that the state has accrued to itself, and we're not just talking about the physical mechanisms of wholesale surveillance and you know, a massive homeland security, you know, these groups are all infiltrated and monitored, but also the legal mechanisms, the ability to deny people habeas corpus. We see in marginal communities where people of color live, mini police states, where they have no right to due process. I teach in the prison system in New Jersey. My students never got a trial. And in fact, the ones who were usually didn't do the crime, many of them didn't do the crime, and as you said, many of them in there are for drugs. Well, most of them are in there because they're poor and black. If they go to trial, then the way they force you to plea out is by stacking you with 15, 20 charges, most of which you didn't commit, including major charges like kidnapping, which has 25-year sentence, and then saying, well, we'll remove this, we'll remove that, and you can go to prison for 11 years or whatever, 15. These sentences are quite long often. But if they go to trial, then they get all the charges. The public defender is not going to spend more than 10 or 15 minutes with them. I mean, I've taught people in prison. I taught one guy who had life plus 154 years, he never committed a violent crime. It was all weapons possessions and drug charges. That's not uncommon. And so they use those people as kind of poster children and say, well, look what happened to them. You don't want to go to trial. So 94% roughly of the people in our prison system never got a trial. Mm-hmm. Then you've got all the SWAT teams that can kick down doors. These people are going for nonviolent drug offenses, terrorizing people in the middle of the night. You've got, you know, it's far worse than stop and frisk, racial profiling. As you know, I sued President Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which overturns the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act that prohibits the military from acting as a domestic police force. We won the case in the Southern District Court of New York. The Obama administration immediately appealed. It went to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit wouldn't rule, because it's so patently unconstitutional. And what they did is they used another case. I was part of the case against Clapper versus Amnesty International on wholesale surveillance. Was the Supreme Court said we didn't have a right to bring the case. So the Second Circuit said, well, he doesn't have Hedges. It was Hedges versus Obama. He doesn't have a right to bring the case. In that case, he doesn't have standing. And so, therefore, he doesn't have standing. And so they never ruled. They just threw it out. And we filed a cert or petition to the Supreme Court. They wouldn't take it. It's now law. So they have the mechanism now to deploy the military in the streets of American cities, to seize American citizens who they deem to be terrorists, strip them of due process, and hold them indefinitely in military detention centers. That's law. And we saw what happened to 110,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. In fact, Judge Catherine B. Forrest, in her opinion, cited that internment of Japanese Americans as now being legal. So the legal and the physical mechanisms are there. And again,
but in effect, you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the folks who run this society, they kind of know that they're pushing against the potential for a real blowback and are therefore taking these steps almost in preparation.
Completely.
The very thing I said in the first half, we don't prepare for the storm. This is a storm they are preparing for.
Yeah, and the Pentagon's preparing for climate change. They've issued numerous reports. Even the head of the CIA, Woolsey, wrote a long report, I think it was 2003, talking about not only mass migrations, but mass migrations from the coast of Florida. I mean, they have to live in the real world if they want to retain power.
Just a quick fundraising update before we return to today's economic update with Richard Wolf, who today is in conversation with Chris Hedges. So far this hour, we have yet to raise a dime. Now, our goal is $3,000, and my pledge to you is that if we can make that $3,000 goal, then next week, once again, we can bring you the vast majority of the show intact that you tune in for. $25 pledge makes you a basic member to this radio station. We need to average about $100 per pledge, so that could be one $25 pledge. It could be another $175 pledge. It could be somebody who can afford a $500 pledge or a $1,000 pledge, and you will be pledging for those folks that perhaps right now are unable to make that contribution. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. Now, it's important for us to be able to make this goal of $3,000. This program is one of our most listened to programs on the grid. It's a big audience, and we need this hour to work if we are going to be able to keep the lights on around here and keep this radio program at this spot each Friday at 10 a.m. Yet, recognizing that so many people out there tune into this program, I've always felt a responsibility to give you what you tune in for, rather than play a documentary or someone else's speech or something else that we think would help us raise money. So, let's keep this happening, folks. Give us a call or go online. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org. We now return to the show.
So they know very well what's coming, and they're ready. Unfortunately, you know, we live in a society utterly awash in electronic hallucinations, Derek Jensen calls them. We're awash in lies. And the corporate press, you can see it, you mentioned it in the first half of your show, but the coverage of the devastation in Houston and Florida, what was it? It was feel-good stories about heroic rescues or dramatic photos of flooded streets or center, but not a word about climate change. These are patterns of, because we have disrupted the climate, these are going to become, Houston will get hit again. Florida will get hit again. We know this. That's climate right. Scientists have
they
run.
They expect Jose, the one that's already building,
exactly,
to do it again.
Right, model after model. We know what's coming. But the corporations, in particular the fossil fuel industry, and we can't let the animal agriculture industry off the hook, they have a lock on systems of public information and public education. So, yes, they know what's coming. Yes, they are preparing, both legally and physically. And I think what's most ominous is that when you walk into marginal communities where poor people of color live, that is their practice space. And should there be unrest outside of those communities? I mean, mass incarceration, which is obscene in this country, 2.3 million people, almost all poor people of color, although the poor whites are increasing, including women, are swelling that population. That's a form of social control. They do it through terror. This is what lethal police force in this country is about. It is not, it's like lynching in that it's not just about killing, I think, 3.1 people, unarmed fellow citizens, usually people of color, poor people a day. but it, like lynching, it creates a state of terror. So that if you are the parents, even the mayor of New York has had to concede this, if you are the parents with a young black man who walks out, you want him
home
by dark, because he may not come home. I mean, this is just like Jim Crow South. And when Hannah Arendt writes about the plight of the stateless, she herself being stripped of her German passport, living in France with no rights, said that when you create both the legal and the physical mechanisms to strip people of rights, rights become privileges. And that's where we are. And once rights become privileges, then they can be taken away from anybody. So I live in Princeton, which, you know, is increasingly the domain of the upper 1%, unfortunately. And so you don't see it. You don't see it in Manhattan. But all of the mechanisms, the constitutional mechanisms by which we once were able to defend ourselves, have been taken from us by judicial fiat, by a reinterpretation. I mean, the Constitution is quite clear in the 14th Amendment about search and seizure. They don't have a right to all of our personal information without a warrant, yet they have it. Right to privacy, all of that's gone. And then they'll take, through Citizens United, the absurd idea that unlimited, dark, campaign contributions by corporations is the right to the petition the government, or a form of free speech. These are the legal system, or the judicial system, the 1 million lawyers in this country, when the history of this country is written, you know, where were they? Where were the, you know, all these people talking about the you know, going back to the Constitution, like Scalia and others? Well, what about privacy? What about search and seizure under the 14th? You know, the legal system, as, you know, I don't want to draw comparisons too tightly with Nazi Germany, but they have been a bulwark of, they've sold their soul to corporations and corporate power. And this is not just true. I mean, we have figures that the Trump administration, Gorsuch and others, has pushed. But Obama was just as guilty as this. I mean, most of the federal judgeships that he appointed, they were all corporate lawyers. They all serve corporate power.
Listen, you know, I'm reminded, because of being in the field of economics, as I'm watching the so-called tax reform process underway, that from Trump on down through all the others, there's this endless talk about helping the middle class, wow, the lower class, cutting their taxes. And when you look at what they're actually doing, there's something here that's almost genius. They're cutting taxes on corporations, 12 ways to Sunday, and on very wealthy people. The numbers are that you can put together are clear. But their ability to have the press carry their verbal nonsense instead of the analytic means that you have a kind of general consensus to do something which the same people who believe in this would hate if they understood what happened to them.
Right. Well, first
what's
of all,
what's going on? You're the journalist in a way. Tell me.
Well, first of all, it's not a tax reform; it's a tax boycott.
Yes.
I mean, most of these Fortune 500 companies are Citibank. They don't pay any taxes at all. So let's be clear about what they've orchestrated. That's the first thing. The second thing, and Matt Taibbi did a nice book on this called Divide.
Right.
There's a two-tiered legal system in the country. So if you're a small business owner, you are crushed. I mean, you can pay up to 40% of your profits in taxes.
Right.
You have all sorts of regulations. But if you're Goldman Sachs, that's very different. And so the perception among our dwindling small business community is that government is intrusive. There are too many regulations. Taxes are too high. Right. And they're right. But on the upper scale, where all these lobbyists, banking lobbyists and hedge fund lobbyists, are writing the legislation, it's naked kleptocracy and pillage.
But then tell me, for all these small businessmen, and I agree with everything you said, they've been through this now. They have seen their critique of the government as intrusive and burdensome be used not to relieve them of the burdens, but to help the biggest ones. They've been through this. Can they be fooled again?
Well, it's not a matter of being fooled. It's where do you go to get the information?
Yeah.
I mean, PBS is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Koch brothers. No, literally.
Yeah.
The NewsHour, I mean, I was just on WGBH. David Koch sits on the board. So where do you go for the information? You have to go to the fringes of, to your show, to what I write. But we've been so marginalized. And I, as I was saying before the show, that's not true in Canada. I'm on prime time on CBC nationally for a half hour. That I want radio. I'm nationally in France on Radio France, or you know, my last book got a 2-page spread in Le Monde. You know, it's on. And of course, my last book here, although it got on the front page of the New York Times Sunday Book Review, was given to the troglodyte George Backer, who trashed it, which is why they gave it to him. Yeah. So it's that kind of rational discussion of economic pillage and corporate power is unacceptable within the mainstream discourse, just like climate change, just like all sorts of stuff. And so, unless you're extremely proactive, and most people are not proactive about getting information, and less people read, which I think is a tremendous problem, because you have to struggle through. I didn't read all of 3 books of Marx's Capital, but I did get through one, which has more math than I needed. But you have to read that. You have to read Pulliani. You have to read the stuff you write. You have to. And so that takes. I mean, there's, I think, a small percentage of the population that will do it, but it's probably in single digits.
Just going to take this quick moment as Chris Hedges and I think Richard Wolff are talking about the importance of a radio station like this one, KPFA, to have these type of conversations, which are incredibly difficult to find in other venues, to let you know that one of our very own listeners in this hour, in fact, within the last 10 minutes, Robert in San Francisco, called in a challenge to us, to you, to all of us, to raise $1,000. And Robert is willing to match that $1,000 if we can make it by the top of the hour. In other words, we have about 15 minutes at this point to raise $1,000. If we're able to do it, Robert in San Francisco will also put and match that $1,000, and that will be $2,000 towards our goal. And now we have a real shot at making this. If we are unable to raise that $1,000 by the top of this hour, we will have to call Robert his money back, and we'll have to call him and offer him his money back. And Robert, I am extremely thankful to you for your attempts to help me out this morning make our goal. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Pledge online at kpfa.org. This matching period starts now. We've had a few other calls come in, and I'm definitely going to thank those folks here in a moment. But the matching period starts right now. And if we could raise that $1,000, your donation to KPFA, to Economic Update, to this radio station, will be doubled in the next 15 minutes. So the phone number again is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. Let's go back to Richard Wolff in conversation with Chris Hedges.
All right, here comes the $64 trillion question. Given what you write, given what you see, given what I see, given what I write, given what our audience, which is why we have an audience, is it premature to think of a significant movement for social change emerging here in the United States? In the title of your book, The Moral Imperative to Revolt, is that imperative being felt and seized and internalized by the people of the United States, or at least a significant portion? Do you see the blowback from everything you've witnessed and described? Do you see that?
Yes, but it may be a far-right blowback. There is going to be blowback. We're in a period. Alexander Berkman wrote an essay, and he talked about, you know, when old ideas, you know, in the old turn of the century, it was monarchy, divine right of kings. In our case, it's neoliberalism. When they lose their credibility, and neoliberalism has lost. It's a zombie ideology. No one believes. Even the banks don't believe it, because how can you believe it if you then go loot the U.S. Treasury? I mean, who knows what they believe other than greed is good. Yeah. So that ideology, which quite effectively stripped the nation state of its assets and impoverished the working class to make it the working poor and radically atrophied and diminished the middle class, it doesn't have its currency. But we don't have, and this is what Berkman writes, anything to take its place yet. And so that's a very dangerous moment. For me, a seminal and very frightening moment was the reaction of the state to the Occupy movement. Because what the Occupy movement asked was so tepid, as so many. I mean, if you remember Tiananmen Square, or even when I covered the revolution in East Germany, originally in Leipzig, the opposition just wanted legal recognition. I mean, they ended up overthrowing the Stasi state. So what the Occupy movement, what did they ask for? They did have demands. They asked for that corporate power be restrained, that there'd be jobs programs, that there'd be universal health care.
And that the 1% 99 would not be that way.
Well, and that they would not be burdened with $100,000 in student loans while they were working in a deli. So, you know, these were very rational, reasonable demands. And what was the response of the state? It was in a coordinated effort under the Obama, was to shut them down physically.
Yeah.
And that is dangerous. So is there going to be blowback? There is. But that blowback may be very ugly. It may be blowback by a disenfranchised white working class. What happens when these people realize that Trump has sold them out?
Right. Big question.
And they've all got guns. I mean,
and he is selling them out.
And he is selling them out. And thank God, Charlottesville, these on both sides, but in particular on the right, they were armed to the teeth. And all you need is one person to pull out their Glock and start firing the crowd, and you've got dozens wounded and dead. And that's what's coming. And, of course, that's a gift to the state, because then they use it. What they wanted, they're already using it to demonize the left. It's why I've been critical of the Black Bloc and Antifa. Their goal is to shut down even those of us who are nonviolent anti-capitalists. They want that shut down, because internally these people are frightened. They know far better than you and I how utterly corrupt and depraved the system is. And I think Occupy frightened them immensely, more than the Occupy activists understood. Because if anybody knows how game the system is, it's all those criminals sitting in Goldman Sachs or Citibank. I mean, let's be clear, they are criminals. They are clearly under, if we consider massive fraud a criminal activity, they should be. I'm kind of a prison abolitionist, but they should be handing out soup somewhere, in Camden, New Jersey.
Cleaning their diapers. Yes. Right.
Yeah, they know. And they're prepared. And the seizure of any state, paralysis, this is what we have, is political paralysis. The inability of the state or the government to respond to the most minimal rights and needs of the citizenry, and the diversion of all resources to the further enrichment of a global oligarchic criminal class, means that eventually, because these people only know one word and that's more, it means eventually there's blowback. But given the fact that the left has been so decimated in the United States, and what I see as often articulating the left, in groups like Black Bloc and Antifa, which I find immature, juvenile, and catharsis is not how we carry out a revolution, throwing a rock through a window. We have to be extremely tactical and well thought out and disciplined. I mean, we can have another show on Lenin, but Lenin understood, and Lenin understood the danger of random acts of violence and terrorism, which he was rabidly against. So we could very well slip into a kind of corporatized, militarized, it's not fascism, because as Sheldon Wolin points out, in fascism, politics trumps economics, and corporate totalitarianism, economics trumps politics, but some kind of very frightening dystopia.
Well, I don't want to leave us on a note of dystopia, but it's a realistic process, and we have to face it as part of
the maturity. We have to fight it. And, you know, that's that great line I use at the end of my book. I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win. I fight fascists because they're fascists.
That's right. Thank you very much,
thank
Chris.
You.
And thank all of you for joining us once again. I hope you found this as fascinating and interesting as I did. I look forward to talking with you again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. John Trudell at a benefit for the UWA of Colombia. The many remembrances that were written about John Trudell after his passing on December 8, 2015, showed the extraordinary width and depth of his engagement. Most know of his music and poetry, or of the films that he participated in. Not everybody knew that up to 1979, writing and performing was not even a thought or plan or dream of his. In the 10 years prior to 1979, Trudell had participated in the Indians of All Tribes occupation of Alcatraz Island that began in 1969. From 1973 to 79, he served as national chairman of AIM, the American Indian Movement. This 10-year period of activism ended for Trudell on February 11, 1979. He had led a march to the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., when 12 hours later, a fire of suspicious origin burned down Trudell's home on the Shoshone Paiute Reservation in Nevada, killing his pregnant wife, Tina, their three small children, and Tina's mother. All friends and observers of John Trudell agree that the murder, and that's really what it was never explained that it could have been an accident, was the turning point in his life. Trudell said he withdrew from the world and writing words became his way to keep some sanity and continue to survive. But unlike others who, after such unspeakable loss, retired for the rest of their lives, Trudell re-engaged and went public again. He was an early supporter of native fishing rights. He participated in the forest protection campaigns of the 1980s. He helped tribes who resisted uranium mining on their lands. He spoke against nuclear war and was arrested at the site of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant in 1981. And he became an early voice for climate protection. Trudell also became a historian and thinker of great depth on both the indigenous history of this land and what he called the legacy of Columbus. He compared Columbus to a virus that caused an epidemic we all are now suffering. Trudell became one of the eloquent anti-corporate critics of so-called Western civilization. His extraordinary concept of how the combination of fossil fuels and technology created the most powerful corporate industrial Reich, as he calls it as a play on the Third Reich of Hitler. That concept makes us realize today why the fight for climate protection and against fossil fuel use is so devastatingly difficult. The talk you are about to hear was part of yet another engagement of his. John Trudell supported international campaigns against fossil fuel extraction on indigenous lands. Here's the conclusion of his talk in support of the UWA of Colombia, whose fight against oil drilling continues to this day. John Trudell with a mini lecture on voting.
When you vote for the lesser of the two evils, I condemn you. You doing? Actually, if you vote for either one of the evils, I condemn you. You doing? By our acceptance of the lesser of the two evils, so to speak, we're using our intelligence to create what goes on. See, I don't vote. I never have. I vote in Amsterdam, whatever that means. Right? Picked a winner, too. We didn't have to have recounts, so we knew. But I don't vote because, I mean, my reasons for not voting are very valid. See, when they created the voting system here, the democracy here, when they created it, I was the majority. Hey, look at me over here. Oh, I see you, so you're the enemy. You can't play. So the little old majority rule thing came out of the smallest number of people, all right, the smallest number of people on the entire hemisphere, continent. All right, they decided it was going to be majority rule. There's something about it, right, that I don't trust. I inherently don't trust it. And I don't understand why you do, okay? So now that we're the smallest numerical minority on our own land base, they say, come vote. In that scenario, who's stupid, me or them? Anyway. And I'm bringing this up about democracy for this reason. And it's about coherency and using our intelligence. I think that every generation of human beings has a responsibility to decide how they and their immediate descendants will live with the earth. I think it's our responsibility. All right? I think it's our responsibility to do that. When I look at democracy as a native person, see, to me, it's just another chain. You know, freedom is a lie. You know, democracy. I mean, you know, think about it. Every democracy had a landowning class. Every democracy had some form of slavery. Every democracy had some form of sexism. And I'm saying this not because I'm trying to overthrow anybody's anything, because, you know, it just, you know, it's not about that. It's about, oh yeah, it's about the next generation. We live in an evolutionary reality. And maybe it needs to evolve. And maybe in the best interest of our seventh generation, it may be the enemy. But I don't mean just it by itself. I'm talking about all of the industrial faces of control systems. Whether it's democracy or fascism or socialism or any one of these industrial faces and mechanisms to control the mass of people. Because every one of these systems have a small class and an ethnic rich. An industrial ruling class and a planetary ethnic rich. And every one of these governments, no matter what they call them, they serve that master. So don't misunderstand me. This isn't about, you know, this is about a perceptional reality here. I come from a tribe. And whatever's been going on in my evolutionary journey, I still remember that. I'm confused about a lot of things, but I remember that. I remembered it when I was born. It's never been a question about the memory. But they're trying to take that memory away. But the memory of the tribe, see, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, Geronimo said the Americans, and they're messed up, you know. He called them the Americans. See, so I feel a kinship to those ancestors and what they saw and what they tried to stand up against. I feel more of a kinship to them than I do to be a lapdog to this system and promote its lie. All right, because I think it's irresponsible. And I think that when people are afraid to think about what needs to be thought about, that's the danger of the lie. Casualty of war, afraid to think. You know, so I will say democracy because you're not supposed to say anything bad about democracy, but I'll say it. And I'm not saying what I'm saying. I don't look at it as I'm saying something bad. I'm just saying this is what it is. You've heard the other side, so I want to say this side. Right? Freedom of speech. Yeah, let's go to freedom of speech. See, I think the part of the lie there, all right, it should be about responsibility of thought. Freedom of speech, responsibility of thought. Responsibility of thought will then take care of free speaking. But freedom of speech, or freedom, it isn't about freedom of speech. Let me make this more. The idea of freedom. See, words, every word has its own meaning because it makes its own sound in a vibratory world, all right? So every word has its own meaning. You know, so like democracy, that noise, that sound, noise, whatever it is, my ancestors 30 generations ago never heard that sound. That noise was never made here on this land base. It's alien to this. In a way, he was just killing time. Or was time killing him? Which way did Up go? After he found down. Away in a city, it's lonesome in town. Away in a country, all is not fair. Away in a heart, he's been locked out. Away in a dream, who has he become? Away in a mind, been through the wrong. Away in a society that just can't see. Away in a way, how it feels to be free. He was just killing time, or was time killing him? Which way did Up go after he found down? And for us, so about words. So I think the word freedom shouldn't be used so frivolously. You know, and I think that somewhere in the course of this, it is about responsibility. This is a word that needs to float around in our consciousness. We need to plant that seed and let it nurture in our consciousness that life's about responsibility. Because we will synchronize closer to what it is we seek in our life. Because it's very difficult to deal with an abstraction of freedom by a people who don't know who they are and what they're saying, you know? Okay. No offense. I'm not talking about you unless I am, right? And believe is another word, right? Freedom, believe, democracy, believe. See, I come from people who have beliefs. And I'm a part of those beliefs, and I respect those beliefs because they're part of my reality. But then on the other hand, every time I hear somebody say I believe, it makes me cringe inside. So I cringe a lot. And you go, what? No, hold it. Misuse of a word here. Throwing the wrong sound out into the vibratory world. It should be more in harmony, right? The sound. And I think believe might be a word that's not in harmony, although that's the illusion that's been created that we've been led to believe. But see, I think it's better to say either I know or I don't know, or I think. I think. I have intelligence, I think. My intelligence has been drugged with misinformation. My intelligence has been sent on a trip. I'm tripping, so I believe. I mean, can we understand it that way? Friends. So it's more passive, right? Believing. And I think we should respect our intelligence, and it should always be active. You know? It should be active. If we can create our own daily insecures and miseries and fears, we can use that same intelligence to create a whole much better reality, I'm telling you. See, and the collective reality, all the causes and movements and the things that we feel are right and that we chase, see, that reality is not going to really change until we change this other one. And here's why I'm going to say this, because this thing has been going on for like 3,000 years. You know, everybody's been protesting and standing up to see, but as it gets us and alters our perception of self and reality, right, the same old struggles come, see. It's just a new generation saying new words, dancing to new music, to new instruments. But it's the same old thing. Check out a little bit of Paris or France in 1430. Check that place out, man. Right? It's the same thing. Check out the rise of industrial civilization or the industrial revolution in America in the 1800s. Same thing. So the same struggle by the human beings to just try to stay alive, right, has been going on for a long time. So what I mean is, like, so it isn't that we haven't been trying for such a long time. We've been trying to write a thing to make it more ride the balance. It's us who are being mined, so we need to interfere with that mining process. So we need to become as clear as we can. You know, it's a responsibility. There are no rights and no freedom without responsibility, I guarantee it. To not be afraid of the word, see, I think responsibility, I think that's the liberator's word. Right? You want to be free, then be responsible. Right? You want to be free, then be responsible. I think that's the liberator's word. Because then we are taking direct action with our intelligence. Because, see, there's not anything wrong with us. How we perceive reality. But from this moralistic thing, there's not something wrong with us. We really need to be, we need to be real to ourselves. We will get closer to synchronizing our balance. The first thing is we need to be real to ourselves. We need to be able to face ourselves, because if we can't face ourselves, then, you know, we should think about that. Because the other thing is, whoever it is, the coming generations, the creator, whoever it is, if we're not willing to face ourselves, all right, then in some kind of a way, we diminish our respect for them. Because we are here to be real. But if we would look at ourselves clearly, the Dene, the Navajo have a way of saying going to the fourth mind, which means to look at everything. But you rise out of it, You look at it from outside, from the top, the bottom, all the way around, from the inside. You look at it from under it. You look at it, a thing for every way that you can, and you see it for what it is. And then you act. See, and we need to understand to do that without judgment. It's not our responsibility or our right to judge. You can judge nothing without judging yourself. It's just that reality, you know. So what's the trip, you know? And it's already been determined that most of us, we've judged ourselves negatively through our fears and our doubts and our insecurities. So let's look at that thing about judgment. It's our responsibility to see clearly and learn from what we learn from our clarity and our coherency. That's our responsibility. It's not our responsibility to judge and condemn. So in order to be real to ourselves, you know, we got to be careful about self-rationalization and justification and these little things that pop up disguised as something else. We need to be real to ourselves. And if in our reality there are shameful things, all right, then don't lie to yourself about it. Because a shameful thing isn't necessarily really a shameful thing, it's how we perceive. See, everything should be seen exactly for what it is. Because it's also time to turn another thing that goes back into the spiritual reality that's been altered by the religious reality, and that reality is, there's too much pride. The way I see pride in some ways used, see, I think pride is something I'm proud of you. See, I think it's something you give, but it's not something you take. Because every time I've ever seen anyone take pride, they take too damn much of it, and then they fuck the thing up. I've seen it organizationally. I've seen it individually. I've been the player. Right? So I think, you know, maybe in life is really more about humility. See, we come from an ancestral past, a part of the genetic memory. See, where humility was connected to our participation in reality, and we were grateful and we were thankful. See, so many times, again, out of using the word as a habit, see, many times, all right, when we say I'm proud, really we're happy. And wouldn't it be more clear to just say that? I'm happy, or I'm glad, or I appreciate it. The pride comes from the human, but these things come from the being. Because, I mean, it's these types of alterations that were done to us, all right, that keep us from synchronizing. The only answer is that we have the intelligence and the responsibility and the ability, all right, to create the solutions to the problem that we're confronted with. Because there are no solutions now. I guarantee you, you know, you can deal with the lesser of the two evils, but there is no political solution. And I think you know that. I think everyone knows that, right? But they just feel powerless to do it, so they want to avoid dealing with that reality. And I'm saying, hey, let's look at reality and deal with reality. I got intelligence. I accept the challenge. I have the ability. This is why I was given it. So there are some miscalculations in me. I kind of messed up a few times along the way. So what? I learned from it. It's part of who I am, right? But that doesn't mean the coherent parts and the clear parts aren't clear and aren't coherent. Somehow, in some subtle way, it's been created into the human being's minds. They say you got to be the perfect person in order to get it done. But at the same time, all right, nothing's perfect, and we all know that and say it. It's like a contradiction. So just accept ourselves for who we are and show respect to our Creator. All right, by using the gifts that the Creator gave to us. And I'm not trying to get you to believe me or not believe me or any of that, right? But it's really about thinking, you know. The objective is about thinking. Because our relationship to power is connected in our relationship to clear, coherent use of our intelligence. All right, you had some rain here, right? And some wind. Okay, so let's look at us. Every human being is a raindrop, right? And when enough of the raindrops become clear and coherent, they then become the power of the storm that the existing reality has to endure. And you can't arrest it, indict it, change it. It has to deal with it in a realistic way. Well, maybe human consciousness. Maybe we're all snowflakes or raindrops. We're little tremblers in the earth, right? Maybe we're all part of that. See, when we become clear with our coherency, then this collective thing happens. And you have power. And on the way to that power is the power that we connect to as we live our lives. Because I'm telling you, you know, how many of you feel powerless to deal with your life? And I'm telling you, if there's anybody in here that feels powerless to deal with your life, you know, don't take 2 aspirin. For the next generation that's coming, I think an understanding about the value and reality of the intelligence, of our intelligence, I think it's very crucial that they have that understanding to make it through this, because we're being mined at a rapid rate. And I think it's very crucial, all right, to the continuation of the living species, not the humanoid species, you know, I mean the living. So it's got to be put into the intelligence, them to have an understanding, the next generations. But the only way we can do it is we can't tell it to them. I mean, we can say it to them, but we have to show it to them. Because we are a part of an evolutionary reality, and we will influence the evolution. We will, because our intelligence is always active, so it's just about taking responsibility. But we will influence the evolutionary reality. And we can influence the evolutionary reality out of a base of loss and frustration and self-judgment and things that's been going on for the last 300 years or 400 years here, which has led to this situation. Or we can use some clarity and coherency and influence the evolutionary reality in a more clear and coherent way. Every struggle that we must engage with, whether it's political or economic or social, all these struggles are necessary, all right, to keep circulation going. The other part of that reality is we have to outthink what it is that we're challenged by or that oppresses us or does whatever it is. We have to outthink it. It's that simple. The first act of being free and liberation, all right, is the act of taking our intelligence back, taking our imagination back, our ability to think. That's the first act of liberation. That is the very first act. All right, of conscious liberation. The first steps towards respect for the Creator is understanding that we have that intelligence and doing the second act. It's our intelligence. And for our next generation, you know, we have a responsibility to direct as much intelligence into that as we can. Because this thing about life and death, you know, this technologic reality has been around for 3,000 or 4,000 years, however long it's been around, you know. But its whole reality is based upon death, so therefore, at some point, it must die. Our whole objective as human beings is to stay alive. To get it, I mean really alive, not surviving and existing. I'm talking about alive, connected to life and living. See, we have to outlast it because we can't outfight it because its violence and its aggressive mindset, all right, is beyond parallel. But that doesn't mean that it's powerful. That just means it's violent and it's aggressive and it's without parallel, and you better be damn careful of it. But that's what that means about power. Our relationship to clarity and coherency in the use of our intelligence is our relationship to power, and we can outthink it. Simple math, the mathematical thing. In the authoritarian state system, only X amount of people are given permission to think. Okay? So at some point, theoretically, we will out surround them if we will just do what is necessary to get there. Your descendants and my descendants depend upon us, right, to keep the reality of the living alive. And we are going to influence the outcome no matter what we do. So all I'm talking about is, well, let's take some responsibility, right? And let's influence it in a more clear and coherent way. Outthink them. Trust ourselves and our ability to think. And each and every one of us was given just as much intelligence as we need. It's not a contest. I'm going to close now. And I thank you for being here and getting whatever you got out of this, right?
Thank you.
I'm not responsible. I'm just this rag doll, and these entities just here. I want to vent today, so here, get him. Raven brought beaded serpent and the Alaskan thunder. Realities yet to come. Good thoughts are good way life. Wrapped in the universe, the unborn sleep in dream time. Day and the sun is on its way. Think good thoughts, thoughts of lightened mind. Dream dreams dreaming brings. Sense rush of newfound find. View where harmonies sing. Follow the sky into the blue. You are part sky. Sky is part you. There are stars that bring the night. There are thoughts to bring clear sight. Thinking good makes for a strong heart, nourishment for spirit and soul. A good path, a good way to give. Belief creates what we believe. Good words, good thoughts, good actions, a way human beings live. Raven brought beaded serpent in the Alaskan thunder, and I thank you for being here.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour talk by the Native American poet, musician, and activist John Tudell. Rebroadcast in his memory. John Tudell died, age 69, in December 2015. He spoke in March 2001 at a benefit for the UWA of Colombia. Tudell had someone make one final post to his Facebook page 13 hours after he passed. It read simply, "My ride showed up. Celebrate love. Celebrate life." John Tudell, February 15, 1946, December 8, 2015. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
This is the Taylor Report. I don't know if I can identify that. So it sounded nice. And were we going to be talking to Ann Garrison? We're working on calling her. So when we get her, I'll be the first to tell you. I will tell you that you ought to be reading Ann Garrison. She's published, you can find her articles, SanFranciscoBayview.com, it's sfbayview.com. Though I bet if you wrote sanfranciscobayview.com, I bet it would come up. She also writes for the Black Agenda Report, and she's had a number of good articles recently. We'll try to put them up on the our Facebook page because Anne has very conscientiously followed the story of the events in Rwanda and the type of leader they have and the mysterious intimate relations between Bill Clinton and Benjamin Netanyahu and Mavunyi. My goodness, I'm Museveni. I used to know the man so close. I actually was in the same room with him. Anyway, Museveni. All have a very special relationship, and Anne is one of the people who has followed it and noticed it. And but we hope to be bringing her. But in the meantime, I'm going to tell you why I think her latest report's so important. We talked on, I think last week on the show, about the young woman, Diane Rwigara, and she is the daughter. She lives in Rwanda, which makes her story so remarkable. She lives in Rwanda, and she has challenged publicly Paul Kagame's leadership. There was a thing called the election, and she notified the world that she was going to, while living in Rwanda, was going to run for president. And the first thing that happened to her was that as soon as she said it, of course, the world noticed. They said, there's somebody inside Rwanda who's actually going to challenge this guy who's been known to kill people and speak very, actually say that he, no matter where you go in the world, he'll find you. I mean, this is a vicious character. And it's true. He knows Bill Clinton personally, which I think he thinks is an insurance policy. And Clinton loves him, and he loves him back. I love love stories. And he's even fond of Obama, and Obama's fond of him. Another insurance policy. So anyhow, she, Diane Rwigara, had the temerity to say she would run. So immediately in Rwanda, nude photographs were published of her. That was the first reaction. All over the net, there was a photograph of her, nude. And that was the way they handled it. It's like, oh, we see her naked. And that's the end of her presidency, right? It's amazing. I love the, you know, we need Freud on this, or maybe Wilhelm Reich, to tell us what is going on in the minds of these guys. They think, what has this got to do with politics? By the way, if you got any pictures of Bill Clinton, we'd all appreciate. This is the story. And so she, of course, was not permitted to run. And then they said, they made up a bunch of reasons. Now, she comes from the inner circles in Rwanda. The reason she had the temerity, she comes from circles that are used to getting a little bit of respect in society. And, of course, her father had once been someone who gave Paul Kagame money, a lot of money, so that he could arm himself and kill people. And, by the way, I think this is somebody, Phil, a phone call, that if you would take that outside, we may get to the bottom of our mystery here. Quickly answer that, if you would. Thank you. We think we might have gotten Ann Garrison on my personal phone. Now, about Rwigara, Diane Rwigara, and her candidacy, she was the next thing that happens, the thing that always happens, which is that she was found her house surrounded and her power cut off. And she and her mother and other members of the family were basically under arrest, but not in the bed. Some people say, oh, she's perfectly safe. Nobody's perfectly safe. If the authorities cut your power, cut your phone lines, you're already a prisoner. Any baloney about your not, you know, because the original story told here by, I think, David Himbara and others, as conscientiously as they could, when somebody disappears, you say, well, where is the person and what are their circumstances? They said, oh, look, she's at her house. If you're surrounded by police and you can't use a phone, you're in more danger than if you were in a jail. Because if somebody says they're in the jail, that's part of habeas corpus. That means that's where they are. It means they are in somebody's hands. They're being held. But in this case, that wasn't clarified. I see a thumb indicating that we might actually have the journalist, Ann Garrison, on the line. Are you there, Ann?
Yes, I am, and I'm sorry I forgot to turn the phone on.
Oh,
so I was charging it.
It's perfectly natural. People turn their phone off.
And then I started reading something regarding what we were going to talk about,
yeah,
which is an interview that I did with a Korean peace activist and scholar resident in the U.S., KJ No. It's a piece that's in the Black Agenda Report, Locked and Loaded, War with North Korea Cannot Be Contained, but Must Be Prevented. And this is really comprehensive history of relations between Korea and the Koreas, Korea then the Koreas, and the U.S.
Yeah. Well, that would be interesting. As you know, we're going to ask you about Rwanda.
Yes, of course. Of course.
By the way, I've just been explaining to people, you are an independent journalist based in the San Francisco Bay Area. The articles you've written, I read today's really great journalism, and I got to compliment you. It's sfbayview.com. Please go and read these articles, too, on the case of Kagame versus the Diane Rwigara. But also we want to talk about Victoire Ingabire. And I may as well just lay out our agenda. We also want to ask you about the way people do comment on Kagame. I know you are one of those who believes that some are reckless in comparing him to other figures in politics. But let's start with the latest news on these two women. And I insist, I know you do. We cannot talk about Diane Rwigara and her courage and the fact that she's now in a really dangerous place because nobody can quite figure out the circumstances, only because she ran for president against Paul Kagame. But then there's also Victoire Ingabire. So let's actually – your article brings us up to date on Victoire, who's been in prison for 7 years. She has some problems. What are those problems that are facing her now as a prisoner?
Oh, it seems that 10 members of her party there in Kigali have been arrested, which means there's no one to deliver food to her in prison, as they have been for years, because they have concerns for several reasons about her eating food provided by the prison there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are in this strange situation. I know many who have been who are in prison in Rwanda, and I hate to say that. We ought to also be calling for the freedom of all political prisoners, which would number in the tens of thousands. But that is that their friends and family have to deliver the food to them, as many of them are not fed. Your friends have to bring you your food. And she has special needs, right?
Yeah. Apparently she requires some special diet medically, but I know there are also anxieties simply about what she might be fed in 1930 prison, if it were left to prison authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Several days ago, it was just Saturday when I spoke to Joseph Bukaye, an officer of her party in Brussels. He said that she had not eaten for 3 days.
Mm-hmm. As I read your article, they arrested the people who were bringing the food.
Yeah. They arrested everyone at their party office. And they've released three, the driver, security guard, and house worker. Mm-hmm. But the seven officials of the party are still in prison, and as of Saturday, they had not eaten either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this – and, of course, the vanguard of human rights, Washington, and their little vanguard in Ottawa, their ambassadors don't call and ask about the treatment of her, do they?
No, instead they're pushing for the ICC to indict the Burundian president and or other Burundian officials for crimes against humanity, which the UN Human Rights Commission has reported on, although the UN Human Rights Commission is itself a gallery of UN human rights abusers. Last year, Burundi announced its intention to withdraw from the ICC, from the jurisdiction of the ICC, and the rules of that court are that it required a year's time to complete the withdrawal, and that will be completed on October 18th.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly there's this push to indict Burundi.
They have been doing this for some time. By the way, in credit to the Burundian resistance, they really haven't been that successful, have they? I mean, Kagame, if we were doing this interview a year ago, the heat was really on Burundi, with Kagame openly brazenly harboring people who had used, armed warfare against the Burundian government. It would look like they were going to overthrow the government of Burundi. Now that they didn't succeed.
There was someone who worked for the UNHCR who was doing work in the refugee camps in Rwanda, interviewing Burundian refugees, who said that they had been threatened and or forcibly recruited into a rebel army to go back and try to overthrow the government of Burundi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now that somewhere that's going to be Burundi is making its own case against Rwanda, and that's being heard, right? That's going to be heard.
Now this is something perhaps I don't know about. In what venue?
My understanding is that they have brought that to either the African states or to perhaps UN. I shouldn't speak out of school. I'll look into it. But on the main theme here is that, yes, they would. Rwanda still wants to unload its own crisis onto Burundi. But they now have two highly visible individuals, Victoire Ingabire and Diane Wigara, that the world is beginning to notice. And again, by the way, thanks to your writing and Black Agenda Report and the San Francisco Bay View.com. Really, our biggest – I noticed you did an interview with Joseph Bukhi of the FDU hyphen in Kingi.
Right.
And you asked him what the best thing to do was about this. You tell us what his answer was to that?
Well, he said to turn to the press, try to get press attention to the situation, ask governments to demand that the prisoners are given due process, fair trials. And he particularly emphasized the U.S. and the U.K. because the U.S. is donor number one to Rwanda, U.K. is donor number two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have an excellent article called Bill Clinton's Favorite African, Paul Kagame, and that's very true. The reason there hasn't been this attention, of course, is the pressure from the U.S. But, I'm going to suggest, Anne, that one way we ought to take your article from all of our listeners, take the sfbayview.com article about the situation of the two women who've challenged Kagame, and just send it to the local media and say, why don't you just print this? It's an excellent article. That would be a good place to start, would it not?
Well, it's a thought. This part of the world is still very remote to most Americans, and so that might be a difficult argument to make. I think perhaps less so in Ontario there, because the Rwandan and Congolese communities seem to have a more visible presence there.
Mm-hmm.
That's my impression.
Well, yes, and we've had Mr. David Himbara, who himself had was told by Canadian authorities, British authorities, that Kagame was a threat to his life. And he does live here, and he is known and heard from. And so I think you're right. I think the climate has changed, and perhaps we could get – but I still would tell the local press, just take the Anne Garrison article as the starting point. It would be the thing to do.
And you have to make the point that this is a longstanding ally. Why should we care about this? Because this is a longstanding U.S. ally, and because the U.S. is donor number one to the country doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding Rwanda and Burundi, I think I remember what you may have been referring to about the venue in which Burundi has been making its case. That is the African Union. Mm-hmm. The African Union refused to support a multilateral African force going into Burundi in, I think it was 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And now, again, they've opposed Burundi's indictment for crimes against humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So it will, because the AU has said they won't support this.
Yes.
If the ICC indicts Burundi before October 18th, it will be a blatantly imperial act.
Yes. Yes. Well, by the way, again, this is Ann Garrison, and an independent journalist in the San Francisco Bay Area. She is the winner of the Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza Democracy and Peace Prize, given in Brussels, very deservedly. And you've outlined the case. This is very important to remember. The Paul Kagame government is responsible for endless crimes, starting in 1990 with the invasion of Rwanda. It was a story that's not been properly told. But through the cases of Wigara, Diane Wigara, and of Victoire Ingabire, if properly researched, would lead to that revelation. People killed in Congo and Rwanda and various other places, Burundi. But, Anne, I got to ask you, you have a concern, and I share it, which is, as people writing about want to emphasize how bad they think Paul Kagame is, some of them will begin to use words like, oh, he's like the leader of Iran, or he's like the leader of North Korea. And I know that this has troubled you. Can you outline why?
Oh, sure. I haven't heard the Iran statement, but I have heard this comparison to Kim Jong-un a number of times, especially since the election. Kagame won, quote-unquote, won 99% of the vote. Well, supposedly Kim Jong-un did as well in North Korea, and I'm not even sure if anyone runs against Kim Jong-un on the ballot, but this is a radically different kind of comparison. You're comparing a U.S. ally who has been supported militarily, politically, diplomatically for decades, meaning Kagame, and the leader of a nation that has been under siege by the U.S. and its colonial allies, most notably Japan, mm-hmm. since the mid-19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Korea has been in a defensive crouch, in danger of being hit with a nuclear weapon mm-hmm. since 1953.
Yeah.
And so to read the whole history of that, I would recommend this piece in the Black Agenda Report, also in Counterpunch, Locked and Loaded, War with North Korea Cannot Be Contained, but Must Be Prevented, an interview with KJ No. And I also would urge you to have KJ on the show at some point. I mean,
This is a brand new article just out today.
No. This was actually published on the 16th.
On the 16th.
But this threat to annihilate North Korea is ongoing.
Yes.
Trump said he threatened them with fire and fury like the world has never seen. And then, let's see, I'm trying to remember exactly what John McCain threatened them with recently. It was either annihilation or extermination, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all talk this amazing language. And, you know, for people trying to help themselves on, you know, on the making a point about Paul Kagame, this, you know, these are just two very different things. I mean, in the case of Korea, as you point out, this is a direct U.S. Nuclearized confrontation with a state, whereas in the case of Rwanda, you have a sponsored dictator who invades his neighbors with impunity.
And by the comparison, you're buying into the demonization mm-hmm. of North Korea,
yes.
which is being used as an argument to go to war with North Korea, and as an argument for the constant war games on the
yes.
North Korean-South Korean border, and for even conceivably using tactical, strategic nuclear weapons, should there be such mm-hmm. a thing.
Yeah, wouldn't you say it's also a form of pandering? It's almost like saying, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be with me doing this other thing. Somehow it would be okay. If we could agree that they were the same thing, then the U.S. could be against them both.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're not
I know
the same
it's
thing.
Done. You know, this has been done with
It's, the it's an argument of a coward or a weakling, I would say. Kind of a bizarre. I decided to throw that out, that people who would argue that way are actually somewhat cowardly. They're trying to find a shortcut, easy argument. And when you take shortcuts, you pay the price.
Well, I think the people who've made this argument, whom I've heard, are all arguing with good intent. And they see the hypocrisy. They see the hypocrisy that the U.S. continues to support Kagame and threatens Kim Jong-un and North Korea with annihilation.
Yeah.
But there's a much more applicable comparison and hypocrisy right next door in that the U.S. keeps focusing on alleged human rights abuse in Burundi and now pushing for an ICC document, ICC indictment, whereas it ignores the human rights abuse that's gone on for decades, including invasion, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and even genocide, as was described in the 2010 UN mapping report on human rights in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which described the Rwandan army's massacre of hundreds of thousands of Hutu refugees in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which it said would be tried as genocide were it ever brought to trial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, Kagame has powerful friends to make sure
not going to be brought to
he's
trial.
Never, but he's never brought to trial. Yeah, and Bill Clinton's excuse when this is brought up is that, well, it hasn't been adjudicated. It hasn't been adjudicated because he made absolutely sure it never would be. He's managed to thus far.
Yes, he's very tight with Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, and if they can get out of jail, he can.
Yeah.
So, this is Ann Garrison. The article, by the way, the title is Kagame Cracks Down Hard in Rwanda, Victoire Ingabire in Danger. That's September 9 this year. And, Anne, it's always great talking to you, and we look forward to talking to you again. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bill. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT. You can write to us at facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. And on SoundCloud, what is it, Phil?
SoundCloud.com/TaylorReport with a hyphen in between Taylor and Report. Taylor hyphen report.
Well, hyphen in our spare time.
A hyphen in our spare time. Absolutely.
And Phil, what is that about the streaming?
The Streamathon on Sunday from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. It's an online fundraising campaign for a different book list cultural center. And go to their website, adbcc.org, and get all the details. But basically, we want you to give $300,000 on Sunday.
$300,000.
That's towards $2
million. Call, give it to them early so that
we can all watch baseball. So the tension will all be relieved. No, don't watch any football on Sunday. There'll be good baseball games on. The Dodgers are collapsing. Yes. Houston is collapsing.
Are they really?
They really are. They keep losing.
just the end, folks.
They're still ahead by a dozen games, but
a few more gray hairs.
But
the Dodgers collapsed again.
They have not won in a week or more, right? And they're playing the Giants tonight.
All right. One exception to the boycott rule: you can watch Aaron Rodgers of the Green Bay Packers. That's permitted. And please object to the Confederate loving moron Hank Williams Jr. being returned as a Monday night guy. We got so many reasons not to watch, including concussions. The former NFL players all have amazing problems. Some of my favorite heroes, guys I admired growing up, and I read about them, and they say they don't even know their own names.
Yeah. You know, there's a story out there that isn't really being covered, but many, many high schools in the United States and Canada now are canceling football programs as they consider them too
dangerous.
I'm
actually glad to hear that. Yeah. And I want you to know that Ted Schmidt has a new book, The Season, by Ted Schmidt. When the 1967 Mimico Marauders dominated Toronto High School basketball. It's, of course, a political story as well as a basketball story. The coach, I think, was Ted Schmidt. And there's a new book, of course, David Himbara, Kagame's Killing Fields. And you got to get a copy of that. That's at the different book list. And I think we have done what we can do. Francois has been looking after us. Thanks very much. And we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.